I call to order the September 22nd Board of Education meeting. Will now come to order. Please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, roll call, please.
Mrs. Wilkinson, present. Mr. Elster?
Here.
Mr. Boschensky?
Here.
Mrs. Nelson?
Here.
Mr. Ellis?
Here.
Here.
Here. All right. Welcome, everybody. Nice to see so many smiling faces. We're going to start off with Lori Campbell to introduce the new District 41 staff. Lori?
Thank you. Well, we're very excited to have many of our staff members here this evening. We have approximately 45 people on the staff this year and a multitude of positions, anywhere from teaching to support staff members to lunch and playground supervisors and food servers, Spanish teachers. So what I'd like to do is I'm going to read out the names of everybody who we hired this week. Some were able to make it this evening and some were not, but I'd still like to read their names just because it's so special. So those of you who are here, first of all, thank you for coming and taking time out of your Monday evening to be with us. Thank you to our administrators for being here this evening, too. And as I say your name, if you could just stand up, that would be great. So in Lincoln, we have Leslie Palmer, who is foreign language Spanish, Jennifer Rose, school psychologist, Dave Huber, reading and math assistant, and then Christy Sandbeck, who's a food server. Churchill, Casey Kirkland, physical education, Lisa Kronke, ESL, Minnie Maywood, special ed bilingual, Yvette Cortez-Lentez, first grade, dual language Spanish, Camille Ponce, bilingual speaking psychologist, Julie Steinhilber, kindergarten teacher, Jackie Atkins, special ed aide, Jill Caprio, library media aide, Mary Ellen Mazza, special education aide, Precious Wade, special education aide, and Mark Maritano, magisterial. Franklin, Dana Augustine, speech and language pathologist, Kirsten Money, psychologist, Kathy Deacon, special ed aide, and Bailey Nunley, special ed aide. At Forest Glen, Lauren Bittner, resource special education, Tara Frey, speech and language pathologist, Carola Lanya, ESL teacher, she's also Ben Franklin. Kira Quintero, Manley, music teacher. Margaret Nelson, special ed aide. Carrie Weedman, special ed aide. And Erin Waterloo, special ed aide. At Hadley, Nate Brown, sixth grade language arts. Alexis Detmar, speech and language pathologist. Janet Franco, ESL. Ryan Gidley, special education. Caitlin Matthews, science. Frank Modica, science and social studies. Becky Perez, school psychologist. Heather Rosenwinkel, foreign language. Chris Seacook, special education. Tiffany Alicia Wheeler, psychologist. Jackie Ackerman, school secretary. Abby Hinton, special ed aide. And Molly Murphy, special ed aide. And then in Central Services Office, we have Michelle Gallo, our director of student services. Patrice Bronwig, our payroll clerk. Craveo, chief communications officer. And then at all of our schools, we have Rebecca Harms, who's our elementary orchestra teacher. So I want to thank all of you for coming this evening. Welcome to District 41. We are thrilled to have you here. And thank you to the board for the opportunity to introduce our staff. Yeah.
Welcome, everybody. Yes.
I'm sure. Yes. I'm sure they want to hear me speak.
Yeah, I've run now.
As that a short presentation.
Run quickly.
Yeah, so we'll let for this transition time. So I know we got some other community members who will come in and have a seat.
This thing, huh?
It's been on.
Okay. Welcome, everyone. I think we will start with public participation. And is our process to report back first or to go first?
Report back first.
Okay. So on the report backs, we did have quite a few questions that we answered by email this week. Let's see. Mr. Cooper, are you here? team? I don't think so. Okay. We met with Mr. Cooper on quite a few topics with the superintendent, and appreciate the time that we were able to do that. I think there's one question we didn't follow up on, which is a substitute teacher, and Paul and I got together and decided that we wanted to do some further analysis and get some metrics around that so that we can better respond to the answer. So we plan to do that the following meeting and not this meeting. Ms. Clark, I believe you had quite a few questions, and we sent you an email response, so hopefully you get what you needed there. And then Mr. Buchholz, you should have gotten a response on your question through email, and right now, until the matter gets resolved, we probably won't comment publicly on it, but hopefully you got an email from the superintendent with some.
You didn't?
No.
I sent it out. So you and I will chat afterwards. Cause
so
I
we
sent
put
it
an email together. And
probably Monday or Tuesday.
To respond to your question on facilities. Okay. Those were the three topics. As a part of our process here for public participation, do we have our public participation slide ready to go, or
no.
Public participation one? Okay. We should probably have that every time until we get the hang of it. But essentially, for non-agenda items, today's agenda items will be around, we have a report on special education, and then there are no other items on the agenda at this point, correct? Am I reading that correctly? Is that correct, sir?
Yep, that is correct.
So any non-agenda public participation items from the community? Anybody? None? Let me document a 0-second public participation for the record. All right, then let's move on to presentations. Paul?
Michelle Gallo is going to give us a presentation tonight on student services and the role that she plays within it. And special education overall. So with that, I'm handing it over to Michelle.
Thank you. Thank you, board members, for the opportunity to speak with you tonight and to give you a brief overview of special education and the services we have here in District 41. I thought that it would be helpful to give a brief overview of the federal legislation that defines services for students with disabilities. In 1975, Congress enacted Public Law 94-142, which is what's also known as the Education of All Handicapped Children Act. Congress has amended that special education law several times since 1975, and today it is known as IDEA, the Individual with Disabilities Education Act, which was most recently amended in 2004. IDEA ensures all eligible children with disabilities receive specialized instruction and related services. The first purpose of the law is to provide an education that meets the child's unique needs and prepares them for further education, employment, and independent living. The second purpose is to protect the rights of children with disabilities. And most recently, in 2004, Congress increased the focus on accountability, improved outcomes by emphasizing reading, early intervention, and research-based instruction, all while ensuring students with disabilities have access to the general education curriculum. IDEA applies to state and public agencies that provide services to more than 6.5 million infants, toddlers, children, and youth with disabilities in the United States. IDEA Part C, that's really applying to our infants, children from birth to 2. And IDEA Part B applies to children 3 through 21, so once they enter the public school system. So how do we make sure that all of our students actually are getting the help that they need and that we are providing them with special education and related services? There really are two parts to that. In IDEA Part C, we are obligated to participate in a child find process, meaning school districts must ensure that all children birth to 21 who may have a disability So we are identifying them and evaluating them. In addition to IDA, the reauthorization in 2004, Congress also included and emphasized early intervention, which we refer to as RTI, or response to intervention. RTI is a process in which all students are screened and assessed to identify where they are functioning in comparison to grade level expectations and their grade level peers. Interventions are provided to those students who are not performing at those benchmark levels. RTI is a general education initiative, and it's a fluid process that ensures that our students receive additional support and interventions from highly qualified general education staff, and so that students get what they need. Sometimes you'll hear RTI referred to as MTFS, I'm sure in the new authorization after No Child Left Behind, that's what it will be referred to. That just refers to multi-tiered system of supports, so they're kind of synonymous. And really, again, that's just making sure students get what they need, hopefully by preventing from labeling students as disabled. The vast majority of our students who receive an intervention are not later found disabled or eligible for special education. Rather, they receive the intervention they needed to catch up and to make progress in the general ed curriculum. However, for those students who are found that they're not making the adequate progress or the expected rate of progress over time, the RTI process is part of the evaluation process for a specific learning disability and can be included in other evaluation procedures for other disability categories as well, maybe for students with an emotional disability or speech and language impairment. The government recognizes 13 eligibility categories in order to receive special education services. You have a handout, board members, that has a brief explanation of all of those 13 eligibility categories. I'm not going to read each category to you, but in order for students to be determined eligible for special education services, they really need to meet three criteria. So one, does the student have a disability? Do they fit one of those definitions that you have in front of you? Does the student's disability adversely affect their education performance? So in other words, are they found to be discrepant from their peers? And are the student's unique needs, can they only be addressed with specially designed instruction? A diagnosis from a doctor or a mental health professional alone is not enough to qualify a student for special education services. Information from a doctor or a mental health professional is always helpful and definitely should be provided to the school district when a referral is made. However, eligibility is based on a comprehensive initial evaluation. A comprehensive initial evaluation includes all that existing data, including maybe an outside referral or outside diagnosis from a doctor. Any information that's gathered during the evaluation process, additional assessments that may be administered to the students. The initial evaluation report is used to determine what special education and related services this child needs.
Is that true for the RTI as well? In other words, do I need to have the three criteria to go into RTI? Is RTI the first step to go into that the district does on its own?
You would not need to have those three criteria in order to intervention. To be eligible for special education, a child must have a disability and must need special education and related services, or again, that specially designed instruction. If a child has a disability but does not need specially designed instruction, then they wouldn't be eligible under IDEA, but that potentially could be a child who would be eligible under Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. IDEA regulations require that children who are eligible for special education and related services are provided a free and appropriate public education, so FAPE, in the least restrictive environment, LRE. This provision is met when the IEP team creates the IEP, the Individualized Education Program. Children with disabilities must be educated with their non-disabled peers and have access to the general education curriculum to the maximum extent appropriate. Special ed or special or self-contained classes, separate schooling, or other removal of children with disabilities from the regular education environment can only occur if the nature and severity of that disability is such that the education with the use of supplementary aids and services cannot be achieved in that less restrictive environment satisfactorily. And obviously that's going to look different for all children. And Congress certainly recognizes that although those are our parameters to work through, what is FAPE, what is LRE, we are also required to have a continuum of services. So Congress recognizes that all students' needs can't be met satisfactorily within that gen ed classroom, and we're required to offer a continuum of services. A placement decision is made by that IEP team annually. This is something that the IEP team would consider and must be decided with keeping LRE and FAPE provisions in mind. The first option a team should always consider, or must always consider, is where would they be if this is a student without a disability? So what is that age placement in their home school? That's the first place that a team must consider. When more restrictive placements other than that age-appropriate regular education classroom are considered, the placement needs to be as close to the child's home school as possible. The IEP team must consider the harmful effects that could possibly exist from that more restrictive placement, and the team must consider the child's involvement or progress in the general education curriculum. As you review the continuum of placement and services, the continuum starts off with general education with no supplementary aids or services, moves to a resource level of support, which means that the student receives special education or related services for 40% of their day or less. Once a student requires specialized instruction for about half of their school day or more, the child continues down the continuum of services and placements into maybe a self-contained placement all the way down to home hospital placement. On the next slide, you will see that the majority of our students, 74% of our students, receive their services at the resource level of support. So most of our students receive special education services and related services for less than 40% of their day. This is my final slide, and then I will take questions that you might have. This final slide shows that we have 386 students with IEPs in our district. That number changes daily as maybe a student moves into the district with an active IEP or is found eligible or maybe found ineligible and no longer needs special education. So that does change depending on the day. Board members, you also have a chart that has a little more detail about the breakdown of our programs that you can refer to, but I'll help summarize that a little bit for you, which this is basically a summary of that. Once again, about 74% of our students spend the majority of their day in the general education environment with specialized instruction for less than 40% of their day. In fact, many of our students are closer to that 20% of their day. We currently have 83 students in a self-contained program. And when I refer to a self-contained program, I'm referring to a classroom taught by a special education teacher with only students with IEPs. So there would be no general education students in those classrooms. Those students do, however, have access to the general education curriculum. They are mainstreamed or included for a portion of their day, and that could be for lunch, recess specials, or for an academic portion of their day that their team deems appropriate for that child. 66 of our 83 students who attend a self-contained program is housed in School District 41. And as you can see in your board packet, we currently have three of our self-contained programs. We have nine that take students from six of the member districts from the CASE, Cooperative Association of Special Education. So we have three of those programs within our self-contained programs.
So, I'm sorry, of the 16 then, how many of those are in the District 41? Of the 16 CASE.
So these are only our students, not CASE students. I only included our students.
Sorry, I'll ask it another way. The 16 that are in CASE, are they outside of District 41
yes.
buildings?
So, correct. So 83 total are in a self-contained program
okay.
somewhere.
Okay.
66 of those 83 are here in School District 41. And the breakdown is actually on your chart that you have. Okay. Then 16 are in a self-contained program outside of our school district. And then that one other is actually a FACET program, which is also a, FACET is another local cooperative in DuPage County. And we, through our school district, which is CAPE, we don't have a program to meet that child's needs, but it's also in a public education building. And that's the difference between the public day and the private day as you move down that continuum, is all of these programs are within either our elementary schools or our middle schools or a CAPE elementary school or middle school. We have two students who attend a public day program, which is Glenwood Academy, and a public day, more restrictive as you move down that continuum. It's an entire school of students with only disabilities. And then a private day is more restrictive. We have 14 students who are in a private day, and they are in a therapeutic day somewhere in either DuPage County or in the neighboring county.
At what age do they move from our district to, like, District 87?
Let me display the copy of that right here, guys. So it potentially could be at any age.
At any age, okay. Based on their advance rate?
Where they would go to school District 83?
No, 87, the high school.
Oh, because, I'm sorry, the high
because
school.
We go grades K through 5 and 6 through 8.
Correct. So for
but
ninth
at what grade. Point does 9, is it age?
Ninth grade.
So it's age.
Right.
Okay.
Are there any other questions?
What's your, Michelle, from your grade work prior to the district, what's your sense of the numbers of our students and how you see that either shifting or changing, and how do you project that? I know that over the years we've seen a lot of data and support on the numbers increasing just generally.
So we actually, there are several different indicators that the state monitors us on, as well as the federal government. We have to submit our data throughout the year, and our it's called EECOS, Educational Environment, that's monitored heavily by the federal government and by the state government. And they monitor our numbers of students in special ed. On average, as a nation, that has increased. It used to be about 10% of a school district's population had an IEP. It's now closer to 12 or 13, and we're right there. We're at 12%. So we're following that trend. I know that part of the RTI initiative was to see that trend decrease. It did not. So. Again, with our educational environments, we're doing very well. The federal government wants to see our students in that least restricted environment and to make sure they have that access to the general curriculum that our students do.
Any other questions?
So there's a lot of good information here that teaches me a lot because there's a, graphs and charts and definitions, but you know, from a board perspective, as an administration, you're going to be running day in, day out. It's not my job to get in there with you, but from a long-range program, what do I need to be aware of with this? Hurdles, challenges, beware because next year something's happening, or just let you go?
You know, I don't think at this point I would know well enough what specific needs we have programmatically, because I'm still learning that, being new to the district. So maybe a year out, I would be able to better answer that.
What's your assessment process as you look at the district in terms of gathering that information?
Really making sure that I'm in the program, meeting with our administration team, meeting with the CSO team, working very collaboratively with those teams, the assistant principals, to trust them. They're in those programs more than I am, but also so that I'm in those programs, and as well as working with the CASE programs, working with the other CASE administration.
Michelle, I know you just hit the ground, right? So I don't know that I expect answers for everything, but since we're on the numbers page, I just want to make sure this is interpreted correctly. So less than 10% of our kids are not within our district boundaries in terms of special education. which I don't know. To me, I don't know other programs whether that demonstrates a commitment test, special education or not. My sense is it does because we do that. One of the concepts that the board had, previous boards have discussed, and we really haven't had this conversation as a board. And actually, if I step back, one of the reasons that we wanted to put this on the agenda is that we talk about a lot of different programs, and Paul and I had discussed it. We have a new person on board, and we really wanted to start to make this more of a habit, to talk about special ed, because Eric, I don't know, we don't, it's not a regular thing for us. So I'm curious on one of the things that we had talked about as a board was that the community valued what we call the home schools, right, within their neighborhoods. So I see these numbers, and I don't really know, and I think it'd be good if we could try to understand how many of our kids are actually in their home school. I don't know if that percentage is 50, 70, 80, but it was something that a desire that at least previous boards had, with the concept that they should go to the same school that other kids would go to in their neighborhood and be able to benefit from what we call the homeschool.
So if you are a resource level student, then that is provided within your homeschool.
So that's the 287.
So at least 74% of our students are in the homeschool in that general education classroom that they would attend and participate in, even if they did not have an IEP.
Okay. And I'm going to assume some percentage in the 66 as well. I don't know. For me, that's a nice metric to understand just because it's telling us how many of our kids are being homeschooled. Not homeschooled, but in their homeschool. And I think the reason that they wouldn't be is that maybe we have four or five kids that have a special requirement, and that would be a challenge to do in each of the schools. I'm presuming that's the logic behind it. Okay. Again, I know you're not going to have an answer to this, and I don't know if there's a way to do this or not, but I know when I talk to special ed community, the real problem or the real challenge for them is this whole IEP process. And, I understand the process is mirrored in 13 categories, go get a doctor, go get a lawyer, and go through all this stuff. And, I don't know if there's anything that we can do to make that a easier experience, a better experience, an experience where the parent isn't, saying, oh, my God, it's the first day of school and I haven't gotten this figured out. If you have some ideas, great, but to me that would be a good thing to think about as we move this program forward, to how do we make that easier, or sometimes just how do you do the right thing without necessarily having all the bureaucracy done and, just moving forward. So that's something that I don't know if you want to comment on that. Or
I think that's what's nice. When I was a special ed teacher, there was no such thing as RTI. And so it was kind of like the wait to fail system. So a student who we may have known was struggling and was not learning how to read in first, second grade, unfortunately, based on the discrepancy model that we used to have, they weren't expected to know very much on those standardized tests. And so unfortunately, they wouldn't look discrepant. And they wouldn't have been found eligible maybe for a specific learning disability. And now with interventions, very nice. I mean, we have the staff in place in buildings that didn't exist 15 years ago, processes and screening procedures that were able to make sure, okay, who's not performing right now at benchmark, and then we're not going to wait and fail. People are going to intervene right away. Highly qualified gen ed staff are going to say, okay, what can I do to help this child? And we do. And so that's good if then later they don't get an IEP because they got what they needed when they needed it and moved along. So that's a good thing. And I wish that would have existed several years ago, but that's part of the reauthorization from 2004.
So tell me if I'm interpreting this correctly. What I think you're saying is that with RTI, we can get to students faster in terms of do they really need to go on an IEP or do they just need something to move out and continue. Mm-hmm. So, it sounds like that process is more effective with the RTI.
It is.
And where I'm going is then there's the process that says, okay, I know my kid does need special ed, and there's this IEP process.
Yeah.
And I've just never heard anyone say that's a wonderful process and, it's easy and it's quick and all that. And that's kind of where you know, maybe the RTI helps because now you have some stuff, you know, documented.
We'll be helping them along the way.
Right, but it still sounds like if there's an initiative to try to make that better and easier for parents, that, I think that would be appreciated. At least what am I heard. I don't know what else you guys.
Anyone in the field of special education who would say that the IEP is an easy process?
Yeah.
Set forth with the provisions, unfortunately, with the federal government, and we want to work with our parents to educate them and to make that as comfortable and easy of the process as we can, and we're obligated to, through Child Time, to seek out children with disabilities so that we are making sure that they're entitled, getting the programs that they're entitled to.
The question embedded underneath that, John, and I think this is where we've talked before as a board, for our boards, but this one too, is as you look at the process, where can there be improvements?
Right.
Yeah. And that's your new fresh eyes. How do you see that process? How can we make improvements around it? And that, you know, certainly if that goes up through the board and then back to the board.
Right. And that feedback from the parents is really meaningful for us to improve.
And then just my final thing is just around metrics. I think the homeschooling one's a good one. And I don't know if we track, you know, how many kids come into RTI and go out back into the gen, or how many kids go in RTI and go to special ed, and, you know, the cycle time to make that happen, just so we, you know, understand how the process is working. And, again, those are just ideas. You're the new boss in special ed here. You're our new subject matter expert, so you're only special subject matter expert. My humor's never appreciated.
No.
But, you know, any ideas around metrics and cycle time would be useful, too.
Well, thank you. Thank you for this opportunity.
Yeah, I was going to ask, and maybe you got to a little bit of it, too. How much of this is dictated to us, and how much do we have flexibility to improve?
We really have little flexibility with special ed.
So to get through the IEP, I mean, when we want to do this, because I hear the same thing you do, about going through the IEP is never, it seems like, an easy process to get through.
And the kind of joke behind that, in 2004, that was another piece of the legislation. They wanted to make it easier, and they did not.
They did.
They kind of failed with that. So we have, there's the federal IDEA, and then Illinois has Illinois School Code, and we have Illinois forms that we have to use. And that used to not exist, and the Illinois forms are cumbersome.
Well, I think what we're getting at, and what John was saying too, was if there's ways that you think we can improve it, we are definitely open to understanding that, as long as we stay with them, you know, the rules that we have. That's
And I guess what I don't understand about the rules is, you know, if there's a If we feel that a child belongs in special education and they haven't necessarily followed all the rules or the forms, are we as a district allowed to say, let's put them in a special ed class until that gets done? Or are we not allowed to do that because of the rules?
I guess I'd have to know specifically what you were referring to. I mean, really, the unique thing about special ed compared to probably other departments, it really is unique on every single child. Every child with that same disability is going to have a very unique plan, because really there are so many variables that come into play, and what was there. There are different requirements, things that we have to consider about their past educational experience, language that they're spoken at home, language of instruction, how long they've had that instruction. And there are just so many different things, how they responded to those different attendance issues. Are they new to the district? So many things that we legally have to consider, which goes into that process of gathering all that information so that the teams have time to review all of that. It is unfortunate.
All right. Well, my mindset has always been, I think every kid in the district should have an IEP, and this way it's not, you know, it's not anything that is different, and it's an individual education plan, no matter who you are, but I guess we're not there. So,
all right. Any other questions? Michelle, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah, I got it.
And Michelle, what night are you meeting with your parent group?
Wednesday.
This Wednesday night.
Forest Glen.
Forest Glen at
7 o'clock.
7 o'clock. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, we move to discussion items, and there are none at this point scheduled for this evening. Nice job on the agenda. So action items, consent agenda. Joe made some minor corrections and language changes to the September 8th board meeting minutes. A copy of the revised draft is at your places. Are there any items board members would like pulled from the consent agenda to be considered separately? Hearing none, may I have a motion to approve the reports and recommendations contained in the consent agenda, which include human resources, September 22nd personnel report, employee recommendations, resignations, and dismissals, finance, facilities, and operations treasury report, investment schedule, monthly revenue expenditure summary report, the summary of bills and payroll, vandalism report, disposal of surplus property 2014-15, FOIA report, school district payment order September 3rd through September 17th of 2014, authorizations to prepare 2015-16 budgets, and other matters such as the approval of board meetings September 8th, 2014, regular meeting minutes September 8th, 2014, regular meeting closed session, and application of recognition of schools. And a motion?
Motion.
Second.
Second. Thank you. Roll call.
Mr. Elcher?
Yes.
Mr.
Wachensky? Yes.
Mr. Nelson?
Yes.
Mr. Ellis?
Yes.
Mr.
Galante?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, superintendent's recommendations. September 8th meeting, the board discussed the following recommendations. FGM contract renewal, approval of amendments 30 through 34 of the professional services agreement with FGM Architects. May I have a motion?
Motion.
Second.
Second. Any discussion?
I don't think there were any major changes from the previous.
Since last year.
There weren't any changes that were identified in our update or in this report. So.
No, just a couple that Joe had from about a month ago.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Joe, you're good with the changes, right?
I'm good with the changes.
I didn't ask about this last time, but maybe you could just fill us in, Bob. It says in there that some of the fees, hourly fees, are going up on November 1st. And I'm assuming that's built into the budget somehow. I don't know how much of an increase that is.
It's built into our budget.
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right. Terrific. Roll call.
Mrs. Nelson?
Yes.
Mr. Elcher?
Yes.
Mr. Ellis?
Yes.
Mr. Wachensky?
Yes.
Wilkinson?
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Okay. May I have a motion to approve the administration's recommendation with regard to the bid results and recommendation for Forest Glen and Churchill Building additions, approval of bid results as presented by FQC for the Forest Glen and Churchill Building additions in the amount of $4,022,989.
Motion.
Second.
Any discussion?
Again, this is the same. There's no significant change. There were any changes, right?
Not from last week. Yeah.
No. Same as last time.
Yeah.
And there's four remaining trades that will be let.
Yeah, we vetted out the other four. The low bidders all met the standards and so forth. We prepared a recommendation letter. We should see that in the next finance committee.
Next finance committee.
I have a question. Is the approval of this, is it contingent on this evening to meet a schedule on a timetable?
I'm not sure I understand your question, John.
Let's assume that we didn't approve this tonight and it took us another 30 days to approve it. Does the timetable get impacted for this work?
Yeah, the approval was at this time was with the expectation that we would open school then in August, so you'd have the whole school year. A 30-day delay would put that in jeopardy and put us back on the original schedule to be in mid-year of the 2015-16 school year. Because we're right now working with subcontractors to, in anticipation of tonight, to get started in early October.
Okay. All right. Anybody else? Roll call.
Shemsky?
Yes.
Mr. Ellis?
Yes.
Mrs. Nelson?
Yes.
Mrs. Wilkinson?
Yes.
Mr. Escalante?
Yes.
Mr. Elger?
Yes.
Mr. Kendall?
No. Okay, superintendent's report.
I have a couple that will go fairly quickly and one I'll take a little bit more time with. I apologize. The enrollment update, we'll bring that back to you in 2 weeks under the, because we'll at that point, the state of Illinois has a process called the fall housing report, which is due in October. Mm-hmm. Currently what we're looking at are is data through our new registration process, where we actually did a lot of our cleanup work in the springtime, as opposed to years past, we've done that same cleanup work right now. So we really are looking at two totally different sets of data when we're looking at the past one. When we get the fall housing report data, that's when we'll have apples to apples, and we'll be able to look at it a little bit more detailed, what's going on with our enrollment. So I'll bring that back to you in 2 weeks. At that October 14th meeting, which is, I think, 3 weeks.
Is that the 100-day count? There's a 100-day count? Is that what
we used to call it? Yeah, basically, yeah. It's the same thing. This next piece, need to engage the board in a conversation around Senate Bill 16. I'm going to pass out a draft of a letter that we would consider sending out tomorrow to our community. A number of communities have engaged their community members, their parents, with a Senate Bill 16, either call to action or some other type of title around Senate Bill 16. What you'll see in this one is just giving some facts to what it is, what it's not. Senate Bill 16 really is about redistributing the monies, the state funds, to other districts. It really is based off of property taxes. But I wanted to hear from the board the direction they wanted to give administration on this. I think it would be important that we inform the community. This is something that will be going to the House sometime in November. So I would turn it over to the board members to have some conversation, give me some direction. Again, my current intent would be to send out this draft to our community tomorrow at some point.
Any comments?
Well, Joe was the board rep at PTA Council this morning, and the legislation chair for council presented this. I was there for community outreach, but we had a good discussion among the PTA unit leaders, presidents, their delegates from each of the schools, as well as committee chairs. And, you know, one of the things that I think we're aware of is that this has gotten a hair on fire kind of issue now because of the call to action that went out from Len through Peg Agnos, because she sees this moving more quickly in the House now with the fall veto session coming up in November. I know that she's coming to our
October
14th meeting.
Yes.
So that's good information for the public as well, because she really has the pulse on what's going down there and how quickly or maybe not so quickly these things kind of move. Our board had conversation about this starting a springtime. Mm-hmm. We knew. I mean, Len had been talking about this.
Right.
I went to presentation. We were on a webinar about this. And then I asked John and Paul if I could do that kind of mini presentation mm-hmm. in June. So not new information. But I think what we're seeing is that districts are now putting right up on their websites, information to inform. I mean, mm-hmm. the center of the conversation, correct me if I'm wrong this morning, was we need to educate so that people are aware. And that the biggest piece of this is that people hear funding reform and make some assumptions that there's going to be a change in our taxes, state taxes, etc. That is not what's happening here. This is a redistribution of those dollars, and it will have impact certainly, as we know, across the district. And I think
for us, it's $1.9 million.
It's
a little over $1.9 million, so that would be the change.
September 6th, there was an article in the front of the Herald, and the article header is, quiet talks on school funding, so they're not so quiet anymore. And, you know, to Paul's point, the other thing that, not feeling 100%, so I apologize for my voice, was this calculator that Len sent out. So this is one screenshot of the calculator, and I know folks have gotten some of this link to what I highlighted was District 41. But, you know, what you find is that around the district, but for, I think, just a couple of DuPage school districts, we're all going to have a loss in funding. So that's a huge concern based on some of our interests as a board. And it comes, and I know that you did this intentionally, Paul, at a great time, so that as Finance Committee starts talking about the budget, the committee as a whole, the board as a whole, really needs to be involved in those conversations. And you know, I recommend that all of us, as we can, get to Finance Committee so that we're listening to you vet some of this and that we have some of that information. So I think it's important to get that.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know if any of us has comments, but this is... I mean, I agree with you, Erica. This is extremely important. Let me just start off with a general concept. I don't think anything that the state in Springfield will do will ever be in favor of a community like Glen Ellyn in terms of funding. This, something like this was, I don't know, like 10 years ago, 12 years ago, something like that. There was this idea of giving this, you know, the state all the money from property taxes and let them redistribute it, and that would have taken a lot of local control out, and that was defeated. This one, you know, you never know if these things are going to pass or not. I think this one has a little more legs than I've seen in the past, so I'm probably a little more worried about this. I'm not sure about the calculation, and again, my philosophy is whatever the calculation is, it's not going to be in favor of our community. Because I think there's still some uncertainty in the calculation. With that said, it's not going to be positive for us, and I think that we need to inform people. And in the letter that you had, the thing I would like to see if we can talk about, and I don't know if we can or not, but these dollars translate into one of two things, either some program cuts, which is an option, or a tax increase. Essentially, that's the way I'm thinking about it. So, finance guys, help me out if I'm not.
No, I would say there could be other options, right? Because I was thinking about this as well. Mm-hmm. Everything has to be on the table, right? Mm-hmm. So it could also mean student fees increase or the way we do fees or there's different ideas that we can do. But the overall thing is $2 million is up now, going to be off, possibly $2 million that we have to take.
Right, okay. So that's a good point. It's either a program cut or it's some sort of increase, whether it's through taxes or fees or whatever. So I think that, I think that needs to be communicated in the letter. That, you know, those are two options, that are two directions we could go in. And I guess I would urge the community, there's not a ton that we can do as a board. Or as a district around this, because nobody really is going to feel sorry for the poor little folks in Glen Ellyn's Board of Education and their, you know, $1.9 million loss. But if there's a battle to take around, you know, Springfield, in my mind, at least from my perspective, this is it. This is what's going to hit us the hardest in the pocketbook. So I would urge everyone to do so and to do it with diligence.
Mm-hmm. You know what, John, I agree with you. I think a very tangible example of how this could affect a family is something that you might want to include to the, in your draft. I think that's a real good idea, John. I think, you know, you're right. There are really two issues. You know, if we have a hole of $2 million, it's got to come from a revenue source, replacing revenue source, or cutting expenses, you know, however that is. So, I'm with you.
And, Erica, the thing I wasn't sure about is the idea here, this starts, worst case scenario, this starts 16-17?
there's a phase-in, and so there's kind of a hold harmless clause in this, as it were, so that districts don't feel that the hit, which is the projected, until that third year. But once you hit it, then you lose it. That's it.
Right. So, but it's the soonest it would start would be 16, 17 for us.
No.
Schedule to start. Sorry.
Go ahead.
Wanted to answer.
No.
FY15.
Mm-hmm.
First, I'm just looking at the material that Paul sent out today.
Yeah. Okay.
15% of the decrease would go into effect in FY15. So that's not too far off.
Right.
So, and Bob, I don't know what that impact is in terms of your analysis for, you know, we recently borrowed some money, and, you know, what does that do to operations?
$2 million is a lot of funds to take from the district in a particular year or even over a period of time.
John, I'd like to say something about the letter. I think the timing on this is great. Mm-hmm. I think getting it out this week is excellent, especially because it looks like there could be a vote on this imminently. I'm wondering if you want to think about some kind of phrase that shows we're looking at the FY15 budget already, and I don't know how that's going to play out, but some kind of contingency so that we're not left high and dry if indeed this does pass in its current form and we really are left on the short end, that we've started to identify some ways that we can regroup and maybe minimize the, you know, the negative impact, but that we're not going to be caught completely unawares and unprepared.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a historical experience with this just 3 years
five
ago.
Years.
Well, about 5 years ago.
Years
ago. When the state legislature was going to decrease funding again, right, and assistant superintendents and school business officials were recommending 10% across the board cut. Remember that, John?
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, the board, our finance committee, was not comfortable with that, and neither were you, Bob. And so you looked at our budget really as prepared for the 30% cut, if I remember.
Yeah,
it.
I recall.
Yeah. So we have experience as a board and as a district to do that contingency planning, and because of that, we were one of the few districts that didn't have the hit that others did. And it was at a time also where we had decreased, we had taken that $3 million out of the budget. We had already cut at the administrative level.
Right.
We'd not go into the classroom, but transportation. We were bundling services. We had gone to bundled benefits. And I mean, we had done some things through Bob and his professional association to look at that. So that's a great point. My only caution in terms of the comment made earlier is I'm cautious about enumerating ways or things that we would potentially do, because I think sometimes, at least for me, I hear that and then I think that's the answer. And it's such a, this is such a dynamic, you know, thing. You know, we could find out from Peg that in between now and the 16th of October, she's been downstate, and they've been able to lobby the Menar and the other senator with this to, you know, do a little bit less or give us a little bit more in one area. I mean, who knows? So that's my only. Once it's out, then I feel like if we're enumerating, you know, the hit, we may be, you know, getting ahead of ourselves. That's all. But I think the contingency is a good idea.
And I think we have to balance this, you know, as we talk about this, it's a redistribution with the same, you know, we sponsored some language earlier about unfunded mandates.
Right.
And somehow this all has to be brought together, because I think sometimes this is sold on, see, we're improving funding, when really there's no new money coming in and there's still mandates coming at us.
There's actually less money coming in.
Yeah. And so this is a big problem.
Yeah.
And so I appreciate the fact you're going to go ahead and do this. So.
Yeah, and you know, part of what Erica could be referring to is sometimes when we put numbers out and they don't hold in the end, where you know, there's a little discussion about transparency or whatever. So if we do numerate it, right now, based on the calculation sheet that's going out, this is the number.
Mm-hmm.
As long as we say that we anticipate it and the legislation is still going through, it's what a potential impact could be.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I don't know, you throw out a number like 1.9 million, what does that mean to you? Mm-hmm. And we need to get, you know, in some respects, the people need to get excited about deciding whether this is good or bad. And one of the ways to do that is how they understand how it impacts mm-hmm. them. Mm-hmm.
Well, we have a budget, if I can remember this correctly, that we were at, like, what was it, $66,000 surplus and all. I mean, where our budget ended up last year, it was a fraction of it was a thread the needle kind of budget when it all came down, which is great, because we're, you know, it's important that we're, you know, really hitting those numbers. So we're not, and we have board, our finance policy requires that we, a balanced budget is presented to the board. We don't deficit spend it, and it's already all built into our processes. So, yeah, I think like the other districts, we need to get something out, and it's about education. And the link is here. 204 and 200 also have their representatives and senators link on there, so you can go right in and you can.
And I think we'll add that.
Yeah.
We'll add the representatives link that came up today and the. PTA Council thought that was a great suggestion, so we'll add that as well. Really, is our take is maybe slightly different than a few others. Ours is really about here's some information. We're not going to put a bold red heading on it, call to action, unless the board wants us to. We're taking here's some information at this point, unless the board directs me otherwise.
Well, my preference is certainly to inform people of what's going on out there. A little apprehension of using numbers that aren't well defined and that the reader would fully understand. So if you're pulling a 1.96 number, if it is for fiscal year 18, then you need to define it. If there's a 15% decrease,
lay out the graduated schedule.
To me, I mean, when you're saying the numbers, otherwise it could be misleading. Mm-hmm. And I'm just reading the draft in front of me. Seems to fall into that just because we're given numbers and that's what the link leads you to.
Right.
We're not saying the detail that Catherine.
By the fourth year, it would be.
And if that's all you're saying, fiscal year 18, mm-hmm. this is what it is, then that's what it is.
Okay.
And that's good the feedback. Bigger of the number. But that's just my preference. The way you end up crafting it, I just think when you have numbers, you should have the. Back up to which the link would provide,
mm-hmm.
which
you
give the detail what that number is exactly telling
you. No, I appreciate it.
And it's the calculator gives that definition, also talks about the change per student and then the loss, and then after the cap, what that loss would be. So it does lay it out. You could pull that.
You could use their numbers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a good point.
Board members, anything else for me? Okay. Just move one piece around. I need some closure on the board meeting agenda, protocols, time frame.
Well, that's the 21st
century. I'll get to that at last minute, just so I'm not up and down and back and forth. Seem to be three proposals on the table right now. Our current structure, what we're doing right now, which would include first public comment on non-agenda items, second public comment after each discussion item, third public comment toward the end of the meeting, and then a report back to the community in the moment or in writing or at the next board meeting. Proposed practice number, a different one, number one, one public comment at the beginning of the meeting, no other public comment. Report back to the community in the moment, writing, or at the next board meeting, whatever is appropriate. Proposed practice number two, one public meeting at the beginning of the meeting, one public comment after all of the discussion agenda items have been discussed by the board, and then the report back to the community in the moment, writing, or at the next board meeting. Had a lot of discussion at the last board meeting. I just really need direction from, you know, what's the direction you want administration to take with the board meeting?
Well, I thought proposed practice number two was one public comment at the beginning of the meeting, non-agenda items.
Yeah, I apologize. I think that's, you're correct.
And then practice one is just one public comment at the beginning of the meeting.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
So
you're welcome.
number one is one public comment at the beginning, all items?
Yes.
Proposal number two is one public comment at the beginning for
non-agenda items.
And then one public comment after all discussed agenda items.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
So
I just want, I just need a feedback consensus on what direction. So when we're doing the schedule, we know what we're doing. I would ask that we stay with whatever we choose for maybe the remainder of the year, and then we can go from there for next year.
Wow.
Just my take on things. So where do we want to go?
Well, when John brought the approach to test, I thought that it was really good because it gave us some idea of assessment on you know, public comment. We've heard feedback on other boards and how they operate and all that. I think we've all done our studies and done some homework this weekend on it too. But the light bulb for me on the last meeting and then coming through to know we're going to talk about this is that what it highlighted is we've had a shift in interest from community members, certainly people that come repeatedly, but also, or consistently, but also from people that write us or whatever and say, I can't come, but here's my issue. And that is, for me, that it's an issue about conversation and engagement. And so if we're looking for public comment to be able to do that, I don't think that that's what we're achieving. And it was literally, I think, 5 years ago that one of the board goals at the time was around communication. And I mentioned it in the last meeting that the board didn't move forward on this. We just couldn't come to consensus on how. But I really think that timing is everything. And where we are now is that the community is looking to have conversation and discussion, not pop a comment, give a comment back, and then spend 2 weeks and follow up again. I really think that what we're being asked to do, and I think this was the original idea, even with John's suggestion, is to build in those regular conversations. And I think the timing's right to do it. This kind of call to action for us on some level is, can we have deeper, broader conversation about an issue that might be current? It might be SB 16, and we have an open forum about that with board members to come. It could be a general conversation around building initiative. It could be board goal. It could be whatever. But I feel like where this conversation has brought me is that this is less about public comment or participation and more about conversation. And so this is a business meeting. You know, I beat this dead horse, and I apologize, but this is a working session. It's a working meeting, like all other boards do. And what I feel like we have the potential to do now as a board is to get out and really listen. So I went to a 200 board meeting, and one of the things that they do, they call it a chance to chat. And they have them on Saturday mornings, 10:30. This came up 5 years ago, kind of like the Glen Ellyn Police Department do their
coffee with the cops.
Coffee with the cops.
Yep.
So, you know, for me, this is about let's have, you know, public comment at the beginning of the meetings, get that information, still do what has been initiated in terms of if we can respond in the moment, great. I don't want to lose some of that spontaneity, but be appropriate. Catherine, you brought this up the last time, needing to really think through some of these things. But if we can answer it, let's answer it.
Yeah.
And if not, then let's get through our business meeting, have that public comment at the beginning, and then get on a schedule where community members will know this is where we're going to be available, these are some of the subjects, send us an agenda item, I mean, have that conversation. But that's my takeaway, that this is less about comment at and more about conversation with. And
just that. Oh, I apologize.
Mine would be to go with public comment at the beginning of the meeting, have it then, and then that's it, and build in these other conversations. And it's board time. I'm willing to do it and have a tighter business meeting, but really have the conversation. That's my takeaway.
So just one aspect to that is, Maureen or Erica, do we have the dates for the town hall meetings? Would you mind reading those off? So we'll be putting this out in communication as well. But I wanted to make sure that I know that was a piece that John brought up at the last board meeting and that we've talked about.
Wednesday, December 3rd, 6:30, Hadley, LMC.
Wednesday, March 4th, same time, same location. And Wednesday, May 27th, same time, same location.
Okay.
So those are
that's
what we
first
already
step.
Have in place.
That's what well, we just
we
worked
can
on those
increase
today.
Those.
Absolutely. Yeah.
If we see fit, or if there's like we've had sometimes with some topics that we want to engage a community on right away. We were pretty quick at putting together, like, let's do it. And then I think we did it a couple nights during the week. We offered a Saturday. I know all the board members, I think, came and participated in some way or another in that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the best that we can, we'd like to do that. But those seem to be better, richer conversations where we get better information. So I would agree with Erica that proposed practice number one is where I'd like to go with the idea that we have these town halls and schedule them and listening sessions
and
where appropriate.
Yep. Joe, I'll bounce back over to you.
Yeah, I think with a commitment to more listening tours, as we call them, and perhaps another town hall meeting,
mm-hmm.
Practice number one.
Okay.
You know, one of the big things that was put in place, and I give a lot of credit to John for that, is the tracking protocol. And I think that's really important that when we get a comment that it's followed up to its finality. That is, we answer the question as best we can, and we report that back. And that again, I give kudos to John for putting that in place, and that's I think that's it's a huge upgrade from what had been done before. In terms of the commitments, in terms of the additional listening tours and the town hall meetings, if that's going to happen, because I do think that's a more effective mm-hmm. way of communicating with the community. I'm in favor of practice one.
I think it's a tough call, but we have to vote. I think having the public comments at the end of the meeting is misplaced, because we need those comments before we vote. After we vote, in most cases, it's a done deal. So I think at that point, we may just be getting a gauge about the mood according to our vote, but it's not going to influence our vote. So I think our time is better spent listening to the public at the beginning of the meeting before we're making decisions. And I'm personally committed to coming to the listening sessions or town hall meetings or whatever other things that we schedule where we've got a more informal situation. And I think I personally feel more comfortable talking with people in that environment where we can have a little more give and take rather than the formality of a business meeting. So, and I say this, because, John, I know you had a really good intent at restructuring this when you first proposed it this summer. But, we've got to vote, and so I'm going to go with the proposed practice number one. And I respect Paul's request that we stick with this for the year, and then regroup if we need to after that to see if it's really shutting out the public. We certainly don't want that, and we'll have to revisit this if that's the case at the end of the year, end of the school year.
I look at this Erica, like you did. It's a business meeting, and then also how do we stick to something over a period of time. So I looked at both proposals, and I looked at myself as a board member and any future board members that we're not experts at everything. So I like proposed practice number two because it allows for non-agenda items things to be brought up, but more to the second issue of after the discussion, sorry to use you, Joe, but Joe could be in the audience in 4 years, and we're having building discussions. And there might be board members out here that don't know soil samples, blah, blah, blah. And
Joe knows.
To give Joe the opportunity after discussion,
Joe knows a lot, but he knows.
Oh, yeah, what about that? We need to talk about that. So I looked at it that way to say, you know, for future boardmen, for future boards that may not be, you know, land and real estate people, finance people, education, you know, professors and college deans, to give that board the opportunity to hear from a subject matter expert and concerned parents to say, good discussion, but did you think about this? So I looked at it as a business meeting and not to change this in 12 months or 6 months or whatever, but so I go for practice too.
Well,
John, I just think it's like,
well, hold on. Let us have our discussion here. Otherwise, Patrick, clearly to me, you know, proposed practice number one to me is shameful on a couple of fronts, right? And, you know, I'm going to use that word. It's shameful on the front that, you know, we're trying this for 45 days, and now we're saying, well, let's try it for a year, and it's, you know, it's just shameful that we can't, you know, take 30 days to think about something, put something together, and then, you know, reverse it so dramatically. So in my opinion, it is. To Patrick's point, I think the idea, at least that I was trying to bring to the table, was that the community, and this is a little different from your point of view, Catherine, I think the community is saying, we like to be able to say something after we, you know, hear the discussion, because if we come to the meeting and there's more information that's going to be presented, we want to be able to comment. The idea is to comment based on that information, which I think where Patrick is going is that if there's a Joe in the audience and we're doing some construction and he hears the construction pitch or presentation or discussion, he can add value with his comment after, you know, after the discussion. So for those two reasons, I do think proposed practice number one is shameful, because I don't think that we're able to get the community's input by hearing something and then just, you know, doing this after 45 days. I do, you know, I do feel that, you know, I personally, I went back to the tapes of the last public participation that we had at the end, and, you know, some folks commented on value or not. And, you know, I'll pick on Ms. Clark, who raised her hand here, but, you know, she had comments after the meeting around this, and I saw value in them. And, you know, specifically she said, you know, not all the board members hear everything when we do town halls. And by the way, I think I should start back by saying the regular conversation, you know, angle that you're taking in the town halls, that's all great. We should do that. The more of that, the better, so we can engage in conversation. But she brought up some points saying, well, you know, not every board member can make it, it's not recorded, you know, and maybe that doesn't change the way we think about engaging in a conversation at town hall, but it might change the way we approach it, right? So when Erica and I talked about this, you know, what Stephanie said kind of said, all right, well, maybe when we have town halls, we should, you know, rotate more instead of staying at one table or whatever. It's just how we would approach it might be different. It may not change that we do them, but I did see value in that. And I think we have gotten value out of public participation. We've had a couple exchanges that maybe weren't, you know, quote unquote, the way a meeting is supposed to happen. But at least from my perspective, it gave me someone else's perspective in the audience that I hadn't thought about before. And I do see value in that. And I think limiting it to one public participation at the beginning of the meeting is contrary to a lot of things we said were issues. People have to be here at a certain time. They're not here by that time, you know, they can't speak. Not everyone can be here at 7:30. It was a one-way dialogue. I mean, all the things that, you know, 45 days ago, we all looked and said, yeah. And this, to me, is just not, doesn't support that. And this isn't a tweak. This is a one public participation. I don't really know, I'm not sure I know of any board in this district that does it this way, that says one public participation at the beginning, and that's it, not one. At a minimum, I don't see how, you know, five other board members would think practice one is not shameful, and at least practice two should be adopted. And, Paul, I'm sorry, but I cannot commit to going for this for a year, because when this changes, I will put it back on the agenda, and we will continue to discuss this.
That's fair.
And waste everyone's time.
All right, so any other comment? I'm hearing practice one is where we're moving towards.
John, I just want to say that doing this doesn't preclude any conversation outside of what we normally do. That we get a lot of comments, a lot of emails, all that is going to continue. And I really think that the call for conversation is more about deeper, more breadth, more depth. And a public comment to me is to give feedback on. And none of that's not going to change, because every 2 weeks as our agenda comes up or as people look at the agenda, they're going to be able in between to go to board members. I had somebody approach me in the grocery store 3 days ago. So I know that people know some of who we are and have an opinion and feel very comfortable reaching out in a lot of different ways. I do not think it's shameful. I think it's, for me, a call to look at good governance and practice, and I want to do this better, and I want to have more conversation. So that's where I'll leave my comment.
Okay. I'm not leaving you. I'm actually going out front.
I have a question. Are we allowed to comment?
Well, this is a board report. I'm sorry, superintendent report. So according to our policy, we will discuss this at the next public participation at the end of this meeting.
Are you deciding? Are you making your decision right now?
I think I had direction from the board members that they were moving to proposed practice number one.
Thank you.
Consensus. That's what I needed.
This is not a voting. That's not a voting.
We didn't have a vote in the last one. It's just consensus. All right. My piece. First time I've gotten out from my chair behind the desk in a year, so it's a little different for me. I'm doing a presentation on the 21st Century Academic Initiative. Really looking at student achievement across the board. Where are we at? How are we doing? Those types of topics that I'll be addressing tonight. Maybe.
Did I just practice this stuff? Work it?
You touch it up.
All right, so a couple of the assessments that we'll be looking at tonight are the ISAT. In the map. The ISAT, as you know, changed in 2013, where it included about 10 to 20% of the Common Core aligned questions. And in 2014, this past year, 100% of the tests were aligned to Common Core. And then we also use MAP, or the Measures of Academic Progress. This is aligned to Common Core. It's an adaptive test that reflects the instructional level of each student, measures growth over time, independent of the grade levels or age. It's a tool that we've been using, Karen, for how many years in D41? Sorry?
Seven or eight.
So it's been a good tool for us, and many districts throughout Illinois and throughout the country use MAP as one of their assessment tools. The other tool that we use for assessment are the F&P, and you'll see that within the data report. You'll see three. We really tried to triangulate the data between ISAT, our F&Ps, and our MAP data.
And that's Fontes and Pinnell.
Doing my academic jargon. Here, just a quick down and dirty. Here's some data right here overall. For third grade, here's the meet succeeds for D41, the state. Generally, we don't compare ourselves to the state. We do really well here. So across the board, I'll just let you look at those. Here's reading, here's math, and then science down below.
And And is this is with the new Common Core line. So
yeah.
This is when we knew we were going to have a drop.
This is 100% Common Core. Yeah.
This is
and with the new cut scores
that
were applied
right.
2 years ago.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
This is now all apples to apples.
Yes, this is Common Core, ISAP. So here we go. So right up here, current fourth grade class. So these were the third graders last year. Right here in this first section of 75, this is ISAC. So we have ISAC meets exceeds math, MAP, and then ISAC meets exceed reading, MAP fall, spring, targeted reading, and then over here, F&P, percentage of students at or above. All, again, third grade data moving back. And then these are our cohort. These are our cohort kids. So these are the same kids moving from grade from year to year. So the green, when they're in first grade, second grade, and third grade, you can see that across the board. ISAT happened in third grade only. We don't have a K-1-2, so that's why you won't see those for all the ISAT. Please.
When you are you fall to spring, you're taking the average of them all three, because you take them three times. So it's fall, winter.
We just go fall, with that one, we go fall, spring. We see where is their growth, where's the average.
Okay.
From fall to spring.
From fall to spring. We don't equate the winter within that one.
Okay.
And that's a general practice with math, that you use the fall to spring or the spring to spring, whichever one you choose to do. We do fall to spring.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Sorry, this is...
No, please.
This is ISAT over here, right?
So you have different data sets. You have ISAT, you have MAP here.
Yeah, okay.
So each one, and then Fox's Pinnell over here. So you do see different ways that we assess students. So those are our current third graders. Our current fourth graders, the third graders of last year. These are fourth graders last year. Our current fifth graders, again. Seeing the numbers across the board. The MAP data here. Seeing some jumps. You see some ISAT from 77 to 70 from in fourth grade, and that's reading. You have MAP over here, fall to spring and reading. We have some jumps and their targeted reading. And we have our F&Ps, some nice data over there. This is a piece here. That I want us to study a little bit more. What's going on here?
With that, though, when you... I'm looking at your blue line here.
This is...
Now, the Common Core standards were fully implemented
yes.
in the blue line, but not in the purple line.
Correct. Okay. This is 10 to 20% here.
Right.
This is 100% here.
So we're not comparing.
Those are not
it's apples. Same kids, still a different test. And that's why when I looked at it,
right.
I think MAP continues to do some really good stuff with it because they've aligned themselves a little sooner.
The NWEA standards for domestic assessments.
So, but it's still, I still want to look at this. And we need to rip it apart more. We'll be working with the principals, APs. We want to look at that across the board.
Paul, is it safe to say then next year we'll have a bar that'll compare to the 70?
Well, here's the hard part.
Okay.
Guess what next year is?
Park.
Okay. So, but that's why it's important to have the MAP, the F&P. You have to have other consistent data points and assessment tools within our bank, and we do.
Okay. But just so it's clear, again, it is apples to apples. So those scores are, you know, ISAT to ISAT, and there's no, it's a different test, but it's the same. Based off of the same standards.
These are 100% the blue, 100% of Common Core were used,
right.
Aligned. This is 10 to 20% aligned. Again,
but
same
those
kids,
are
same test, but different standards were being applied.
Yeah, it's 100% Common Core versus 20% Common Core.
Okay, so that's different than when we discussed it earlier. So maybe I misunderstood.
Okay.
Those are cut scores, though, right? they do take into account the fact that it's not exactly the same. In other words, that 77 or that 70 would be higher under the old.
Under the old cut scores? Yeah. So, like, if you look back here, these were, this 86 here was when they were using a cut score from 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. These, because we implemented the cut scores last year, this is where the cut score was. But the biggest difference is are the standards that are being utilized in this year.
Oh, okay.
That's the difference. Now, the cut scores, these are the same cut scores here. These two, anytime you have the two bars together, those are the same in ISAT. In ISAT, these are the same cut scores.
But still, the blue bar 70 is at 100% aligned to Common Core standards in the ISAT.
Correct.
The other is only 20%.
Correct.
So that's the difference. So we have a 7 percentage point difference. So from your experience, as you look at achievement gap issues, is that less than what we thought it would be? Is it?
I never want to see this. I'm just being dead honest. Because there's some really great celebrations in other places. So I'm taking the data of the data right now.
Okay.
That's all I'm doing with it, and I'm going to be ripping it apart every day. We've already started with that, really looking at kids and where are they at, and how do they break down with the socioeconomic? How do they break down the minority? What does this 70 mean? What does this 77 mean? That's the next part that gets a few people really excited to be looking at.
There's one piece of data to me that jumps off.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because the MAP score is implemented more than Common Core early on. You just stated
that.
That's correct. We implemented going to the Common Core before other districts did. We were championing and talking mm-hmm. about that. So then when I go and look at more comparative data on your screen here, I go to the, let's do reading to reading on math. What happens to purple and blue?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look at that. I mean, go to the Fountains Canal. Look at that. And this is where you implemented more rigor in the classroom. And now we're comparing more to apples to apples. I'll let you dissect it all you want, but that's the thing that jumps off the board or your
I would agree.
That in the third grade level when it hits.
Just think if we didn't implement the more rigor, where would have that blue line been? Anyways, you can digest it all you want.
So, Paul, quick, I want to Joe's point, and I was going to ask this, but we did a lot last year, right? Multi-age, PBL, all of this stuff.
We did multi-age in fourth and fifth grade.
Right.
We did teacher specialization second through fifth grade.
Right. So I was trying to, okay.
Yeah.
This one right here is...
This one?
This slide. Fifth graders are is the slide that shows all the stuff that we threw at our schools last year and was new, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think if I heard Joe right... And if you confirm it, I was looking at this slide to say, show me a result of all these results. Tell me which one shows us we did good or not worse with all the stuff that we put in. And that's the math things.
The so math, going, the F&P. But I'm not going to discount this either.
Yeah.
This gives me pause.
Okay.
I want to look at it.
Yeah.
Because it's important to look at the data and see what it's telling us. More than just the numbers. What is it? But is there some good news here? Absolutely. So you've got two data points where we trust MAP. Again, schools throughout the country use MAP as a consistent benchmark. And schools throughout the country use F&P as well. It's not a homegrown assessment.
That's what I like about it. Okay, fine. My question is, all the stuff that we did we improve the scores of the students in the fifth grade class that had all of the stuff that went through?
Yes, I mean, when you look at it as a total, yeah. I mean, for this grade level, we had improvements in math, we had improvements here, we had a drop here, we had improvements here, and we had improvements here.
Okay.
So when you look at the whole... Yeah, I mean, it's a good picture. But, again, this will always give me pause. I hate seeing anything that goes down. It's just me. We're a good district. I want us to be a great district. A great district is a district where we don't have these gaps. I'm going to show you some achievement gaps a little bit later that just truly disappoint me. I mean, those are the pieces that I want us to get to and that we're really focused
on. So, again, I want to be clear here. So my elevator speech is the fifth grader, I pulled his slide out, all the stuff that they went through, we were successful in improving the scores of our students.
Yes.
Okay.
I guess Paul and I spoke about this on Friday, but so we definitely want to, and like he said, this is just data that he's got now. He's got to peel it back, but we wanted to share it as soon as we got it, right? So we're definitely going to look into the 77-70,
yep,
what that means. But we also need to look at, you know, the 48-61 and the 48-78, right? Those are,
that's crazy.
Those are huge improvements. So, you know, this is like sort of the steroid effect. We need to understand why, you know, if there's something behind that that we can continue to bring forward, you know, in a positive way, because it obviously was a huge jump that is statistically significant and outside of the curve, just like the 77-70 are. So, you know, we need to understand both sides of that
point. I appreciate it. Because I spent a lot of time here, but I maybe didn't focus enough here on the map I sat. I mean, that's crazy, too. I mean, again, we had a lot of people come in and say math was math. We had no clue what we were doing with math. And you're going to see some data here that math in our district continues to get better, that our teachers are doing a nice job. Can we get better? Yes. So this is current sixth graders, or fifth graders of last year. We have more data on them. So again, ISAT math meets exceeds math. ISAT meets exceeds reading. Math, fall, spring, reading. F&P students at or above District 41 expectations. I mean, that's... Yeah, that's pretty good stuff there. Again, so the math piece. Well, let's look here.
Paul, can I?
Please, I want you to.
If I'm reading this graph compared to the fifth grade one in the previous slide, it looks like over time we're showing lower scores in the most recent year. The blue bar, right?
I mean, like the Fontes and Pinelli, like that last blue bar.
So, but remember, this is, I'm glad you brought this up. What's really important to me are cohorts, kids.
Okay.
What oftentimes what get reported out to, you know, in the papers, this year's fourth graders are doing worse than last year's fourth graders. Shocking. They're different kids. This is what I really want us to be looking at are cohorts, kids. How do they grow over time? That's what parents want to know. How did my kid from last year to this year grow? That's what I want to know. It's a different group of kids. They should score differently.
Mm-hmm.
So really what we'll always try to do, and Karen's always done a beautiful job of this, always showing cohort data. How do we do over time? Do we have all this? Do we have some consistency? Do we have some growth? What is that? So again, here's the old cut score,
which makes this
even more interesting. Old cut score, you know, 2 years there. Again, with the older the kids, the more data you keep receiving.
Well,
John?
And on the ISAT front, we would expect the green bars to be higher than the purple and blue at this point.
Yeah.
Right. And I mean, I see in many places where purple is at one level and blue shows an improvement. So I think that shows us a positive trend.
And we've got some good stuff. But again, I want to look here for what happened with math. I want to look here. I want to just keep looking at each of the data points, but it was really important that we bring this information out, so the community have it out, and this is how we're looking at it. So current seventh graders, so sixth graders of a year ago. Same trend at the bottom, same data. Cut scores, different. Math, cut scores, growth.
Paul, as the kids take that year on year,
does the challenge of the exam change? Like, is the, I had this question from a parent last year, and I remember it, and she asked me, does the test get harder? Are we expecting for the kids to be able to?
Absolutely. Yeah. Year by year, it should be getting harder. It's to make that year's growth. We've got to keep pushing the kids, and what we keep hearing from Park and what we're seeing from the practice, or a number of our kids took that last year. We heard from teachers and administrators saying this is going to be a more challenging test this year, that Park. But yes, ISAT was doing the same thing. We keep raising that rigor. It is a challenging assessment. And when people who examine assessments, state assessments, Illinois state assessments always ranked it as one of the more rigorous assessment tools out there. So that's good news. So hopefully that will help us transition as well into Park.
Mm-hmm. So here's one of the challenges when I was reading some of this and that e-news that NSBA sent out, National mm-hmm. School Board Association, is that when you hit a particular level, and I guess I would, different industry, the same kind of concept, when you get scores for, you know, customer service, right, and you're at 93, 94, 95, moving the needle that last 1-2%, like closing that gap to 98, 99%, is the toughest gap to close. So you're going to show us some of the...
I'm going to show you where we can close our gap.
Yeah.
Because it's pretty telling where we can close it. But the good news, we know. To me, as I continue to look at this, instruction matters. Instruction matters. What we're doing matters on a daily basis. Current 8th graders, 7th graders of a year ago. Again, you're going to see more of the older cut scores within this. Just let the questions by board on this one.
I guess it seems like the map is, you know, the most consistent and the one we've done the longest. Is there any value anymore in showing on the ISAT one? Is there any value in showing 10 and 11 anymore?
Mm-hmm. It's a good question because the cut scores are so different. I mean, it's hard unless we change them down to the new cut scores. I think it's a good question. Does it add a whole lot of value other than, oh, these are the old cut scores? I don't think so. So maybe in our, you know, when I come back in November, when Karen and I do even more comprehensive update, we'll either get rid of those or put them in the new cut scores, just so we have more apples to apples.
Yeah, otherwise...
I think that's a good question.
I think from an ISAT perspective, the other ones you keep because we have the history.
I just changed them.
I think one thing that it does, it's interesting because these are the old cut scores. How are we doing compared to those old cut scores? But I don't know if that's much value, quite honestly, at all.
Well, I mean, if we look at just the last 2 years, there's a number of marked improvements. I mean, really, mm-hmm. 47% to 66%, that's gigantic. And I mean, I see improvements in every type of test in that cohort there. And maybe that, if I'm reading that correctly, that really bodes very well for the changes that were made.
And we've got to let the data play itself out. We got 1 year of data for multi-age and teacher specialization. Mm-hmm. Because it wasn't across the board. Not everybody was doing something different. That's not true. There was a group of people who were. But we need to watch that data. We need to see where that data goes. Here at current ninth graders, again, old cut that John brought up. Math. But... funny that I went more on the negative side of things. Just watching that math in ISAC, it's pretty impressive what's going on across the board in math from Hadley to our elementaries. I'm really pleased. Again, first blush, we're going to rip some of those numbers apart. I'm pleased.
Yeah.
I'm really pleased as I continue to look at that and the work our teachers are doing. For science, nice little jump. This only occurs in fourth and seventh grade. So you don't have, yeah. It's
the testing, that's not the.
Yeah. Not you just can't, you never can. Thank you.
Well, and I do think that we've talked about this before, but if we send this out, we have to sort of annotate some of these assumptions for people. Because, you know, you look at that, unless you're in the industry and you're looking at it, we're putting this on the website, I assume. Mm-hmm. So it's got to annotate or put something there that lets people know why these would be different.
Okay. That sounds good.
You mean from like the 2011, 2012?
Well, 2011, 2012, on the ISAT, you know, it was a different methodology. Mm-hmm. On this, we only do it fourth and seventh.
Yeah, absolutely.
But to your question, John, again, just to clarify, these increases at 91, 94, and then 92, and 95 is with the change in the testing.
This is?
Yeah, impressive. I just want to clarify that. I mean, it is. We're seeing the improvement even with the shift in the rigor of the test.
Mm-hmm. Science was the same old.
Because we didn't do the science standards yet.
They
haven't made it.
So that was
okay. So I want to clarify that.
That's why I think this one's
this
very different.
Yeah, it is.
More detail.
This one is very different. Yeah.
Okay. This is where we've got some work to do. I know this is a little smaller for everybody, so I'll. Our white students, our Caucasian students, 1,600 of them, 85% are reading at meets and exceeds. In math, 90% of them. Our white students are rocking and rolling. We've got some other breakdowns here around minority students, black, Hispanic, Asian, but where I want to bring your eye to is this next piece down here, this low income versus not low income. Not low income, about 1,800 students, 86% are meeting and exceeding. In math, 92%. So if you're coming from a home above the poverty line, you're doing really well. 86% of our non-low income students are reading at a meets or exceeds area. Our math students at 92% of our students. Our low-income students, 507 students qualify for this number. 40% are reading at meets and exceeds. Math, 53% are meeting and achieving. We've got an achievement gap. This isn't a one-year data point. First thing I asked for Nancy to go, that I need a number of years. She gave me a number of years. 1, 2, 3, 4. 4 years back. We've been running a 30-40% gap. This is historical. This isn't multi-age teacher specialization. This is about differentiation. This is about making a difference for all kids. Because we can say all in places. Do we really mean all? Do we really mean all? And poverty matters. Poverty matters. You can have anybody spin this sucker 50 ways to Sunday. Poverty matters. We need to do something about it. What does it do? So I just, again, there's a lot of other data on here, but as I started looking at these numbers and how close the not low income to the 1,800 students to our white students, 1,600, and then the low 507 kids, there's our achievement gap.
Yeah.
This is big stuff. So questions would be, what are you doing? And as I look at it, really pleased with where we're going with the District 41 model. And in that model are pieces. They're difference makers. It's about planning and ensuring that our teachers are ready to differentiate instruction on a daily basis. Critical. Workshop model. You'll see that in the D41 model. It's about differentiating. It's about giving kids what they need when they need. It's about supporting our teachers so they understand all of these structures that we talk about. It's about engaging kids differently. It's about engaging all kids in real-life, practical, hands-on learning. Problem-based learning. It's about giving kids into groups of students that are closer to their life learners. We have we've done professional development, our professional development through planning, which is, it's important that we don't just title it this way. When our teachers are planning, there's professional development woven throughout everything we do. We're talking about the standards, we're talking about instruction, we're talking about the math practices, we're talking about the thinking that occurs in a literacy workshop. Those are opportunities for our teachers to come together and grow as individuals to keep getting better. Our release days, we continue to work on these types of planning structures. Our focus on professional learning communities, that the Team 21 really helped recreate those. Do we need more time in the elementary day? Yes. Yes. I will tell you now, I'm going to be pushing hard that we figure out this problem in our elementary schools. We've got a problem, and I've got to find more time. We've got to find that. But our teachers are meeting multiple times a week, talking about kids, talking about instruction. They're doing the right things. They're looking at student data. This here, this is a big piece in our model. Differentiation. It's tough to say. It's even tougher to do in the classroom. This is a challenge. But through our planning, through our work with our coaches, our specialists, this is the game changer. How do you deliver instruction on a daily basis to all of our kids? All. Not a select group, but all students. Guided math, small group instruction supported by our math specialists. January 15th, we're bringing in Professor Patrick Schwartz, who was just here last week working with support staff. I heard it was just phenomenal. It sounded like it was a great opportunity for teachers to learn in January. The teachers will learn even more about differentiation. Our PBL training, we've supported our teachers. Our expectation is that we have two PBL units this year that they're able to continue to move forward for each teacher. Multi-agent teacher specialization. Trained in the past in August of 2013, Lori and her PD team worked with the level two teachers and asked them specifically, what do you need? They said, we don't want anything right now. We want it in the second semester, and we want to work with our level three teachers. I want time, and I want to see their classrooms. I want to be able to sit directly with them and talk about what did multi-age do, what are those practices. So Lori and her team are heading that up and ensuring that we have the necessary support and continue to visit classrooms and share information. I'm pleased with the direction we're going. The more I see this data, the more I know we're headed on the right track. It's going to be hard, though. What we're doing, it is about thinking. It's about thinking for the adults. It's about thinking for our students. It's about putting them in opportunities to struggle at times. I know we had a community member address me a few weeks ago. He said failure is not an option. And that's a nice tagline, but the reality of the brain, I don't write those things to give me applause or anything. I write them because I know the brain research. And research clearly indicates from Professor DeWick from Stanford, from Burrell from, I believe he's also from Stanford, and a number of other individuals who study brain activity. Failure is an important aspect of how the brain continues to grow. What I want for us are a growth mindset. That our kids, they understand that it's okay. That when we actually fail and we support the kids and they get the necessary learning, through MRIs, they've shown that the brain continues to grow at a faster rate The synapses are occurring at a quicker rate. When you look overall, it's an important aspect of what we ask our kids to do. We want them to struggle at times. That necessary. I don't want them failing miserably and there's no support. That's different. I want them to be able to struggle. And the tasks are challenging. When kids have to put in that type of effort, there's something different that's going on in the brain. That occurs through planning. I want a rigorous environment where students are challenged on a daily basis. I want a place where kids struggle, and at times they are going to make mistakes. But we, as the educators, have this growth mindset that say it's okay because this is where I learn. Look at what you did with this mistake. This is where you're at with it. And I improve. The brain research is so clear on this that we've got to embrace it. It's not you're smart. You're not smart. That's not the mindset we want for our kids. That's a fixed mindset. A fixed mindset says, I'm good in math. I was going to pick on Bob, but that's a bad choice. Mike, you're bad in math. That's a fixed mindset. Everybody can be great at math. Everybody. But we have this understanding that, no, only certain... only boys. There couldn't be anything further from the truth. We need to help our kids understand that struggles are okay. Failure does occur. But what do you do with that failure? You get up. We have incredible teachers who support our kids and they understand the breakdown in the thinking that occurred. And we give feedback. And feedback in our model. Those are pieces that that's the direction we're going. I'm excited about our work, but I know we've got a lot of work to do. I know we have tons of work to do. And that's where we'll keep going. And we'll keep bringing data back to you. We'll keep bringing the professional development back to you. Keep having these incredible conversations about where we're at and what are we doing. So
I'm really glad to see the engagement of the teachers to say, yeah, I mean, to really articulate very specifically what do we really need in terms of growth and development.
We got to hear from them.
Yeah.
And they're telling us.
Well, and you know, the other thing is this came up, I know this came up a couple weeks ago, but you alluded to it too, Paul. But there was an article in the Tribune, and I brought it with me, and it was about the number of substitute teachers. You know, in Chicago certainly, but in the Collar counties and in the suburbs as well. And what the article talked about was over two decades, so 20 years, which is a huge span. But the takeaway for me was the change in the requirement of the type of professional development that's needed and necessary. And so what this article talked about and the requirements that we have in our district in terms of teaching certificates, et cetera, is that you're going to have another level of requirements. I remember 5 years ago, we had people coming and saying, you don't do enough professional development. You know, so it's an ebb and flow kind of thing. But it reinforced to me in reading that study that we had a big year last year with learning. But if we don't, and these numbers on some level, I think, vary out as you start to, you know, parse it out, that without that learning and really concentrated effort and very strategic, about how we're doing professional development. I mean, that's got to be the key. There can't be a minute wasted, and the teachers need to voice like they've done, what is it that I need and want? And then they'll be able to inform you, and then us as a board.
I believe in job-embedded professional development.
Yeah.
Very few times are we going to do a sit and get. I want them embedding their work, their learning, immediately.
Well,
our planning is
the
key.
The statistic is 70% of the learning happens on the job. So it's the learning and then back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that's been our model.
Paul, can we go to slide 13? Were you going to that?
Email.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Can I? Yeah. Can I? Are you going to speak to that?
No, go for it.
Okay.
Get you a
can I? Yeah. I know. I was going to say, I'm going to get you off the horse, but I want to stop that.
See, that's why I hear
you. Don't stand in front of
me. I want to ask the question about the achievement map, and you have a bullet point here on minority. Now, why does race matter? I got the numbers there, but you said your biggest one is low income. Why are you, and it's a negative connotation, but why are you discriminating whatever race a low income person is? Why don't you just concentrate? We don't have all the money in the world, and we're going to lose $2 million in 2018. Why aren't we concentrating on low income as a, let me rephrase it another way. Why are you using minority as a milestone marker to close the achievement gap?
Oftentimes they're one and the same in our district.
I appreciate
that. They are. So when I look at the black and Hispanic and Asian in our district is really different than most districts in the country.
Yes.
Yeah.
Our Asian students are struggling, where most districts, that's a success point. So I still have to look at...
But my question is, are you creating two programs when you should truly you're creating, to me, I can see two programs, and I'm three programs, three, a minority, a low income, and an English language learners. Why aren't we, and I know the third one's fine, but why aren't you creating a single program and hone those resources to the low income students, regardless of race?
So
that whole, you know.
Yeah.
Can I offer something to that?
Please.
No. I wait to public participation. I don't know how this is going to sound either, right? But I do believe, at least with some of the things I've read and some of the discussions we've had, you know, in this room with different groups that have come here, there's low income, which basically says, you know, there's a poverty, a financial thing involved. But for minorities, for Caucasian and black and Hispanic and Asian, there's a little bit of culture that sometimes has an influence on how education in general is perceived. And because of that, sometimes culturally, depending where you are in the world, you know, it can be Caucasian, black, Hispanic, Asian, but wherever you are in the world, that culture and some of the feeling about education and even the feeling of the role of a man versus a woman can lead to gaps. And part of keeping the status around different groups is to understand some of those cultural things that maybe can help influence how kids are educated so that you can close the gap. Now, one might argue that culturally that's the case and those may be all low income, but that's not always necessarily the case. Sometimes you have some very wealthy people that come from a cultural background where, and it's probably more prevalent in women, that culturally, you know, they're not expected to do something in math, or they're expected to have a different role in life than maybe the boy in the family. And that's why I do think understanding this, if you do something about it, right, if you go at it that way, has some value or merit to it. So that was a long-winded...
And I think it matters. But the next thing we're going to do, Patrick, once we strip the data even further, I want to see what is the exact cross-section here between our black, Hispanic, and our Asian students and the low-income, where how many, I'm assuming there's probably a high correlation there, probably in the 80s, if not higher. But I think what John brings up is a good point. There are cultural differences when it comes to education and how we engage, and oftentimes how we engage parents around education really matters.
I guess I'm not saying let's not look into it. I'm just thinking, just to use Erica's marginal returns, if we can get more bang out of creating a low-income program in the economic environment that we're in, I'm not saying don't look at all of those three, but you know, the dollar only goes so far.
This really, this goes to instruction matters. We can create all the structures we want. At the end of the day, what research is really clear is having a great teacher in front of every kid and growing our teachers and ensuring that they have the necessary support structures that they can do this work on a daily basis, that they have the necessary professional development to understand the time. Again, I'm going back to the time piece, the time to be able to ensure that all of this occurs on a daily basis. Time matters, our planning matters, our teachers matter. Our teacher, who's in front of those kids on a daily basis, matters almost more than anything else. When we look at it, when you start stripping away all the research, who's in front of your kids on a daily basis is a game changer. And that's what I just want to make sure we keep working directly alongside in a growth mindset for our teachers as well. It's not about fear. It's about how do we raise everybody up. That's how we do this work.
So, Paul,
sorry.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks. I really want to underscore something that you said in your report. It's not on the slide. This concept that intelligence is not fixed. And I think for many of us, I'm not going to try to incriminate anybody, but when I went to school, you were smart or not.
Yeah.
And we know now that everybody has the ability to expand their brain and grow in intelligence. So I really commend you for saying that. And, you know, I think it's part of our job as school board members to educate people that, you know, this is not a guess or a belief. This is a fact that people can improve their intelligence. So that's great that you said that. And I look forward to the quarterly update on this. Mm-hmm. I think that's really helpful for us in the board. I'm wondering if there are any positives to be gained if we match up from this intervention program with the low-income students. And I think to some extent we're already doing that. But, you know, if you're taking a long view on this and you can really intervene at age 3 or 4 with low-income students and get them on the right track earlier, you know, have you looked into that? Or maybe you've already done it. I'm just asking.
No, they're great questions. It's why I believe in full-day kindergarten for all kids. I believe time matters, and you're absolutely right. Earlier, the better. Mm-hmm. Earlier, the better we can get our kids. The further, fourth, fifth grade, it's harder to catch kids up.
Right.
It just is. If I'm reading at a fourth grade or at a kinder or first grade level and I'm in fourth or fifth, it's really hard. And teaching kids, it's very challenging for our teachers and ensuring that they have the necessary information to be able to support kids in that. So absolutely, early intervention. One of the things I think Michelle walked out or left for the evening, one of the pieces that we're working on, and it's not just a special ed initiative, she spoke about RTI. We're really revamping how are we looking at that, the structures. It's really important. Our administrators are working with that all of the time. How are we intervening with kids earlier? How are we assessing them to see over a 6-week period of time, are we seeing growth in that skill set? Oftentimes you talk about how do you fill in the gaps? How do you fill in the holes? And for most kids, it's not tons of things. It's one or two skills that they need, different ways to think, different the mental breakdown. Where is it at? How is their thinking breaking down? And we need to be able to discover that sooner and give them the necessary information so they can close that gap sooner. Those are pieces we're working on all the time. So I'm really pleased with where we're at with our RTI as we continue to have those conversations with administration on a weekly basis.
Dean.
So this is great information, first off, to see it this way and to boil it down. And what you said about the cultural stuff, I think, is really well supported. There was a study done in DuPage County on this, and a book was written about it called Voices. So I don't know if everybody's read that yet, but if you haven't, it's a great book to get. And what they did is they went out to Hispanic children and Black children that were doing really well in school, and they asked them, why are you doing well, and why aren't more of your friends doing well? And they came out with about 25 recommendations, I think, in the book that talk about things you can do that is outside of what you're going to be able to do in the classroom. And that's where maybe we have some more responsibilities aboard with some of this communication and engagement.
And I don't want there to be a misunderstanding that I don't think there's benefit to all three of those programs. I'm just saying the bigger benefit for the biggest group of students is maybe we concentrate on that and move that directive forward.
And no, I got that. What I'm saying is there might be some things you can do that aren't real expensive that we can all help on too with some of the communication and some of the way to get involvement. Because what they were finding is that a lot of it is cultural, and if we can't, you almost have to get into the talking to the parents and explaining it to them. And that won't cost us a lot. It'll take us time.
One of those amazing programs is occurring over at Lincoln right now, where we have tutoring in the afternoon, where we've partnered with the Glen Ellen Resource Center, where we have people from all ages tutoring and helping our kids. It really is an incredible program. It's expanding the day, more time to read, more time to do math. But we've been doing, how long has Lincoln been working with?
6 or 7 years, but when the refugee population came, that's really when it started.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Started there.
Yep.
How many students after school live there?
That's between 60 to 80, depending upon the time of year, mm-hmm. you know, the population. But they take up to 80 or 85 is their max. And they've been operating at max for several years now, yeah.
And it's volunteer basis for the most part.
They do a wonderful job, yeah.
And it's kind of the pieces that Dean are talking about. There are other ways the community can help. It can't just be between the bell to bell.
They're
just not enough time. I think that's where you were going.
Yeah.
We talked about all these pieces, the ISAP, the park. Again, it's going to be changing the map, the F&P. That's what we're going to continue to use. I spoke about the level 2 and 3 teachers collaborating the survey.
Can I make a comment about that, just in terms of some feedback? I know that on the previous slide it said January through June, so second semester, where you're going to have the teachers launch the partnerships. So I think it would be helpful for to hear back if maybe that January through March, that subset of 3 months, and update kind of where those conversations
Absolutely.
Are, and then April through May, and then that decision point. So that I think will really inform certainly some of what they're doing, but also their comfort and decision around how this will work.
I appreciate that.
How this might work, how this could work.
We will be doing a survey, but it's going to be the Illinois 5 Essential Surveys. This is a requirement. Last year we did not do it. The previous year we did. Now the state is saying you shall, you must, and we have to get much greater parent participation in this. We had very little the first time around, and this has to be a priority for us. The state is saying, hey, you only had, I think we're in the 15% to 20%, when I remember that. We've got to get more parent participation on this, and it's a pretty broad, overarching survey. Board members, anything else? A little longer than I...
A little longer, you?
I know, shocking. Got up. Feel free. Good.
A couple things on the low-income poverty. So your low income is being defined now at the poverty level, which is, what is that? Is that 26,000 or roughly?
I believe it. Don't quote me.
It's rough.
We'll look it up, though.
So I think it would be nice.
I think 26, but I think that sounds pretty high, 22.
Maybe 19,
yeah,
whatever.
It's
but
pretty unbelievable.
I think it would be, it would help us understand better if we understood sort of a decimal place of poverty, and I don't know if we can do this or not, but you know, it's hard for me to believe that, you know, a 19,000 versus a 40,000 from a poverty perspective. You know, it'd be nice to understand where do these kids fit in this, the range of income, to really understand where we have the problem. We assume low income in terms of below whatever that number is, but we might have, you know, a big problem in the just above low income to 40,000, whatever. But so to me, it'd be nice to be able to peel that back a little bit to understand and not just say it's below poverty or less, right? That's number one point for me. I'm glad you said more time. I've been on that bandwagon for a while. I'm glad you've now said it. So hopefully the board will follow through on that. And then I just want to bring this up. I bring it up every time. But when we talk about differentiation, mm-hmm. we talk about all kids. For me, that also means, you know, I've gone into the low performing and the gifted, but there's all these kids in the middle. We just need to make sure that we're challenging all those kids. I mean, some of the MAP data shows that, mm-hmm. right, the improvement and stuff, so that's good. But we just need to continue to have the mindset that it's not just the gifted and it's just not the kids that are doing poorly. You know, there's a group of kids in there that you just got to keep challenging. Otherwise, to your point, maybe you heard my previous speech at the graduation, not the recent one. But that whole concept of, you know, kids just kind of coasting through because they have that natural ability and not challenging them so they fail, so that they develop better, was a part of that. And that's where I think we need to continue to make sure that the mindset in the school is that we are pushing those kids that are doing well and have natural ability, but pushing them to another level, mm-hmm. not just the gifted. So.
Well said. I mean, I could not agree more. Okay. When we say all, we have to mean all.
Right.
Let me share one quick data point, because I just got these numbers, but I shared this morning at PTA Council. Right now, the numbers in our district for what the state of Illinois calls direct certified, which is free and reduced lunch, and so they're already certified by the state that they fall under the poverty level, is 770 students. This year, District 41. That's, I think I figured it out, it was like 22% of the population of the district. So to your point, John, you know, we saw this number, what was it, 507 that fell in our low income, which is another 570 children. But above that, there's another 200 or so that fall into this direct certified, but they're, but they're not necessarily, again, by state. The state uses different codes, but that's an important point for us to understand that we have this population that continues to increase. So
I mean, you know, as an example, I think part of the research was that the low-income kids may be hungry, which is why they started these programs, right, to make sure they ate so that they could work in school and not just be thinking about food, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I just understanding where these kids fall.
It's a complex number.
Yeah.
I appreciate it. They're good questions for us. We'll keep bringing that information back to the board.
Thank you, Paul.
Absolutely.
Are you done?
I am done. Thank you for letting me get up here and enjoy this.
Excellent.
Okay, and just to reiterate for us, this is something we're going to continue to do, so we monitor. This is part of the commitment we made to do this and understand how we're doing. So thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, board reports. This is another exciting part of the evening. Does anybody want to share anything?
One of the things that we do as board members, and just restarting context for the year, is we are all assigned on a rotation to certain activities. The bulk of those are PTA meetings, but also PTA Council and also our Special Education Resource Committee of Parents, SERP. Am I forgetting anything? PTA Council, SERP, and PTAs. I think that's it. So I was at Fort, which I think is a really important part of our work because we get into the conversations at the ground level. So I was at Forest Glen on Tuesday. They have co-presidents this year, Becky Allen English and Kristen Young's excellent leadership. And there are just two quick things I want to point out. At all of our schools is a building leadership team, our BLTs, and that is a really great opportunity for parents to be involved. Sometimes the meeting times can be challenging, and so we don't always get full participation. But I would really encourage those, here tonight, but also listening, who will listen to the tape, to seek out that opportunity, because the BLT directly impacts and has conversation around that Illinois State Rising Star, indicators of excellence, academic, social, emotional, cultural. And so for parents who want to have some voice in that, that's just a great opportunity, and so I would encourage that. So Forest Glen is working on their rep or two for that. A kudo to Buildings and Grounds here at District 41, Dave Scarmato and also Bob Cicera. For the last year, or not quite a year, but they feel like it, they've been trying to get a new sign over at Forest Glen. Similar to Ben Franklin's sign, so that they can have more timely information and have it on Elm. So they are looking to go back to the village. The architectural board slowed it down for them, so they have to go and do more meetings with their community members, but have been very good about it. So kudos to them for wanting to, again, increase information and do it in a way where people will see it. And the last thing I want to mention, and this is true for a lot of our districts, we've really increased, I think our literacy numbers show this, but author visits, and that's really PTA supported without those dollars, and feel free, board members, to join a PTA. Drew, you went to Forest Glen, right? I told them you were going to join the PTA. They're expecting your $12. FYI. But they're bringing an author, Gail Rosengren, who is a Mock Newbery Award nominee for a book titled What the Moon Said. Just huge opportunities for that. So it's an excellent meeting, very well attended, and glad that I was at it. The other quick thing for a board report is on Tuesday, Dr. David Larson, District 87 superintendent, started last year a community forum, and Lori Campbell was able to attend from the district, and I was able to go over for part of it. And it was to introduce the assistant principals at the four Glenard High School, so that as the feeders, as you know, we get to know those people, those assistant principals, like our APs, are really critical parts of the equation for compensation. Gave an overview of the Glenbard Parent Series, just another kudo for that, and that there are a lot of speakers that are very elementary and middle school focused, so continue to include that. And then the speaker, Dr. Michael Thompson, who's been in our district before, who's written a new book with a co-author called The Pressured Child, but the book is not about children's pressure, it's about parental pressure. This was a very, very interesting conversation around his work and his research on that. And there are summary notes on that on the district website as well. So kudos to Dr. Larson, because that's a great opportunity for a lot of us that don't see each other. And it's youth workers throughout the village and Wheaton, Glendale Heights, church, school, health care, DuPage County Board. There were probably, I don't know, Lori, 100 people there? Yeah, really good turnout, so that's it.
We're going in order, I'll go next. This morning I went to my first ever PTA council, which is held in this room, for those who do not know that. And I will have to say that there was at least 25 people in this room that were all dedicated to every student, high income, low income in our district. There you have the PTA presidents, it's Lori Taylor, who is back row there, who's the president, ran a very effective meeting, I must say. But I was very impressed, and there was a lot of discussion at the school level, what the local reports on what's happening. Good overview. If you don't get to see, don't get to go to all the PTA meetings, you're there, Paul. So it was a high energy, a lot of good discussion. I did learn something when you volunteered, even more than I think you did. You just said. Now I kind of understand why you have so many reports to give. I care so much, and I value it. And if you want to add anything to what occurred at that meeting, you're there the whole time, and you were there for all the committee discussions, which was, as I understand, lots of good discussion. Yeah. So.
Thanks for being there.
It was my first meeting. It was very interesting. The other thing that I'd like to add, not necessarily a board report per se, but as a parent, I was able to go to two curriculum nights at Lincoln School. Leader, her team did a great job. The first grade teachers did a great presentation for all the first grade parents. And level two, the same, high energy, very detailed. What's going on in the classroom, in the overall presentation, from full classroom discussion, to small group discussion, to one-on-one, to win time, what your children are doing in the classroom. There was a presentation, there was handouts for you afterwards, if you just as we did tonight. So lots of good detail. PBLs were discussed, and even offered a website for you to go to and get a better understanding of it. So I really, as a parent, I enjoyed it, but as a board member, I was even educated a little more into the detail of what is going on in the classroom.
That's great to hear. Thank you.
Good.
Sorry, Lori, to put you on the spot here, but did we used to have a PTA?
I was thinking the same thing. We need to make sure that's back on.
Yeah.
Duly noted.
Am I getting the eye?
Oh, no. There's no pressure to speak.
Yeah, let me make a couple comments. I wanted to follow up on the things I threw out last meeting. The village took my request to start a bit of a dialogue about the sister city possibilities with this town, I'm sorry, my French isn't great. In France, they're really interested. I went ahead and set my name on Paula John. I copied you in the later on that, and I'm waiting to hear back from the village person. I don't mean the village person. I started the village board, and it sounds like a rock group. But anyway, they're going to refer our interest to a citizen who is running this thing, who I haven't spoken with yet. So it's positive. They had said they've already started looking at what they might do at the high school level, and so they're open to what they might be able to do at K-8. And then regarding COD, a couple of people know we're kind of starting to send out some feelers about what might happen there. I've gotten some positive feedback. I contacted a former colleague, a dean there, who forwarded my letter on to staff in the early childhood area. Perhaps we can make some connections there with our early childhood program. Mm-hmm. But I threw out some other ideas to a few other people on campus and see what I get back. I don't have anything concrete to report yet. I've been thinking about, and maybe we'll talk about this at our board formation meeting that's coming up, but whether we might want to commit to reading a book, all of us. Maybe we don't all read the same book. Maybe we do. Dean threw out a title here, and I just looked it up and would like to pursue that myself. I think we could come up with a couple of possibilities and perhaps agree that over the course of the year we want to rediscuss something and all be reacting to it. Mm-hmm. So it's just a thought.
That's a good thought.
We don't have to act on that thought tonight.
All right. Thank you.
Patrick?
I think he's here.
Yeah. Okay, great.
This evening?
All right, board reports. So, upcoming meetings, October 6th, 2000. Oh, I'm sorry, Patrick.
I just remembered. I needed to say something about the Hadley PTA. Sorry.
No, you're good.
I went to their meeting in September, and the important thing I took away is that their magazine drive is underway.
Yeah, crazy.
They haven't hit you up yet. They might soon, and if you don't feel that you can really sustain or use another magazine subscription, I was really impressed that you can purchase one that they can give to a teacher for use in the classroom or perhaps to an organization that could use it outside of the district. So, it could be a win-win situation, and there are prizes for students who sell the most, so if you're a student, you might want to support them. I just think the tenor of the meeting was great. The budgets looked great. The audits came through clean for their expenditures for last year. The handover from Lori to the next president gone really smoothly. So, yeah, it was kind of like what you said, Joe. It was a very positive experience.
That's great. Thank you.
All right, upcoming meetings, October 6, 2014, special board meeting, facilities planning, 8:30 p.m. Central Services office. October 14th, regular board meeting, 7:30 p.m., Central Services office. October 23rd, 2014, special board meeting, 6:30 p.m., Central Services office. Other matters, or are there any other matters to be considered?
I just a couple quick things. First of all, kudos, John, for getting out the notice today on e-news about Michelle speaking tonight. I thought that was great. And maybe we can do that again. We could do that again for Peg Agnos coming on the 14th.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was a great push out. Two quick things, and these are both Churchill related. An anonymous donor from Churchill School contacted me for community outreach and has made a donation this year of $5,000 to community outreach. And it was a completely unexpected and out of the blue. And as I just shared with you, this number of 770 children who are direct certified is really the bulk of the kids that we support through holiday sharing and community outreach. So that is just a huge help. We have 40 children in our district who are identified as homeless. And usually we have a partner that helps to provide support for them at holiday time. That partner is not able to help this year, so we're looking for another partner. But should we not find somebody? This is an incredible gift that came at a great time. So just want to put that out there. We have incredible generosity in this district, as we know. The other is church-related, and it came through on Kelly Haynes' PTA e-news. And I'll just read it to you. Do you have a great idea for something you would like to see our students experience, tools for the classroom, or ways to connect our diverse Churchill families? We have another anonymous Churchill family who would like to fund projects and make these ideas a reality. If you are interested in having your idea considered, please send it in a paragraph or two to either Mr. Plespitz or me, Kelly Hain, by October 10th, including a general cost estimate and whether or not you'd be willing to help in the implementation. We'll share the ideas received with the donor and a few will be chosen to explore more closely. At that time, you may be asked to expand on your initial thoughts. All ideas are encouraged, whether $10 or $10,000. The purpose of their giving is to focus on providing additional enrichment opportunities for students and our building community among all Churchill families. Another anonymous gift.
I believe that's the third large donation over the last 2 years for Churchill.
I mean, I know that there's other stuff going on in other schools, and that's not either hearing about it or seeing it. You know, so I really want to encourage that information. But there's just, I just want to pop those out there because it really speaks to the, you know, what we're doing as a district. And then the last thing is, we all got this, but it was from our general counsel, Francis and Redelet, and it's about the increased obligations for addressing bullying by the new law that's in place. And I pulled this out because, Dean and Catherine asked the board areas that we want to make sure that we're looking at a policy. And I know Maureen already knows.
Yeah, we already have that one.
The keeper of the truth on this. But it says, this is the other piece to this. Additionally, effective January 1st, 2015, district policies must prohibit cyberbullying and must include a process for investigating whether individual incidents of off-campus bullying should be disciplined by the school. That is a huge departure from current policy and school code. And that is going to really impact every district. Yeah. So this is another, not unimportant. I mean, I'm not saying that, but so, it's important.
Thank you.
Any other matters?
Yes.
Please.
I was digging around on the IASB website, and there you already know that there's an online course that you can take at your leisure on the current issues surrounding bullying and what our obligations are as a school board. And I was thinking about maybe good for me. I don't know for others. Mm-hmm. I don't know very much about the current situation with this, and so. If you just go to ISB and look for board training, it's in there, and online it's, pretty accessible.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Anyone else? Any other matters?
Nope.
No? Patrick?
No.
Okay, last one. September 23rd, don't forget, packets, petitions for school board positions are open and available. It does not go through the districts anymore. It used to be easy to come here and pick up a packet. Now you have to go to the county building and get it there, so know that starts. The other thing is we started about 3 years ago, I think, the board to provide a time before a board meeting for just a conversation with board members, a little orientation to board works, resources that we handed out. There's packets through the IASB that they have available. So I'd like to see if we can do that again, and for anybody that's interested to come and have a couple of those, maybe starting in October, as people decide to pick up packets, hold them, then go out or whatever they're going to do. But I think that's really an important outreach for us to do as a board. So
all right. Terrific. Thank you so much. Anything else? All right. Public participation. Is there anyone present who would like to address the board for the final and last public participation at the end of the meeting? Maureen? I would ask that you keep your comments to 3 minutes. If you need to look at this wonderful stopwatch here so that you can track your time, I'd appreciate it.
This is the last one. This is my opportunity. The meeting comment, I am very disappointed in how that went. I couldn't agree with John more. Paul, I really appreciate all of your information, your passion and vision, and desire to take pride in numbers. When you went over, actually very good to get a view of what you're thinking. Third, robotics.
just wanted to let you all know that I had to take on the 41 robotics mentoring position, and we expanded it to fifth graders. It was just had they previously, so it's fifth to eighth grade, and we're running two teams this year for the first Lego League. And except for the fact that it's all boys, it's diverse. We have autistic kids, ADHD, because this is something that is really awesome for them. You know, they get that hands-on, mm-hmm. and it's really engaging. So I'm excited about that. The team also has two to three kids from each elementary, and then the rest are Hadley. So it is a nice representation of the entire district. I'm excited to watch these kids grow over the next 2 years because we just lost our eighth graders because of a band conflict. These kids will be able to compete again next year, and then some of them even for 4 years, so who knows where that can go. And I'm really glad and thankful that the district is putting support behind this program. And thanks to Steve Dively and Kelly Lewis for all their work in helping us get that going. I hope that we'll be able to work through our technology issues because that's where we're at the moment and that we can't access anything. But the kids have told me that they can access whatever we want on their mobile devices, which, you know, we get some discussions about, I have to say. Anyway, the PBL, or just the FLL is really just a PBL on a large scale, and it's multi-age, which is awesome. They're going to be covering, you know, teamwork, multi-age, brainstorming, innovation, problem-solving, research, presentations, public speaking, science, math, engineering, creation, programming, robotics, leadership, and today we talked about gracious professionalism and cooperation. And this is 40 of the week, Monday through Thursday after school for an hour through December 20th. And I hope they survive. And then fourth, I just wanted to say that I went through the 504 process and it feels great. So thank you.
Thank you.
First, Russell.
I thought I'd comment. Appreciate the presentation. And I appreciate that you're going to monitor this as we go forward. Before you all kind of get ahead of yourselves, and I noticed that some were gladly smiling at me as you talked about some of the scores, some of the things that we talked about with Dr. Gordon when we met with him were, I'll still maintain that this was a haphazard science experiment that was put together. You don't know, have no idea what made things effectively work or not. The things that you have to consider, we began teaching science again last year. We put it back in the curriculum. Did that impact the scores? It had nothing to do with modeling. We've done it the old model. We added monthly all-day planning sessions for the teachers. That had never been done before. It's a good thing Dr. Gordon did, but never been done before. And it was at a cost of $100,000. So, for substitute teachers, that absolutely had an impact. That could have been done in the old model. We taught an hour a day more of math than we did the previous year. Each day, an hour more of math. That could have absolutely been done in the old model. We didn't add an hour to our day. So, as we look at these things and we make comments that with all the changes we made, the scores still went up, or maybe some scores went down. But the reality is, you all have no idea what caused those scores to go up. And you put a lot of people through a lot of things that you maybe didn't have to do if you just made these few changes within the model. These three things that I listed may have had a huge impact. So, again, let's not get carried away with ourselves here when we're reviewing this stuff.
Thank you.
Jennifer Rath. Hi, I'm going to kind of piggyback over on what Kirk just said. There's so many variables here with this data. I do appreciate the presentation, and you've been asking for it for a long time. I really would have liked to see the MET scores and the FME scores for first, second, and third, and how that grew too, because first is not part of the multi-age theme experiment yet. But the variables that I saw that I could think of were the multi-age in 4-5 lit, even 2-5. Last year, the Spanish was during the literacy block. Now it's in the STEAM block. more math instruction due to more time in the lab. Everything in math was dropped. Common Core was kind of picked up. Grades 2 through 5 got additional literacy and math planning, which is kind of a double-edged sword. As a teacher, I love the extra planning, but when my fourth grader teacher was absent 17 days last year, you know, all the research shows that that first month of school, especially with our youngest learners, is so important to set those routines and build those relationships and build up the tone of your classroom. And I noticed this year, like, the professional development started for first grade teachers on September 3rd. They were absent, I think, a half a day of school, and that was like the eighth day of school. Maybe we should let people have a little time to settle in. And to put it in context, where I work, teachers have like 3 days of professional development, and then I guess it's a union thing, but back to the variables. When time was added, it looked different in every school and every grade level. PBL, looping, some kids were looped with the same teacher and same peers. Some kids were just looped with the same teachers, not the same peers. Some were looped at all. Now, some kids, some classes have teacher specialization. Some kids in some schools have the same teacher all day. And there's also quite a range of class sizes. There's also a lot more transition time this year, and we're not teaching bell-to-bell anymore. So, you know, there's the evaluation of the academics, but there's also the evaluation of the socio-emotional, which, you know, I don't see a lot of except for the survey that we had last spring.
Thank you.
Who's Curry?
I just want to say that I didn't think the math scores went up, and math was sort of what I was looking at the most. I mean, in first grade, they were way high, then they went down the next 2 years for the fourth graders in math. They were sort of flat in reading. In fifth grade, where we sort of started the experiment, they were way up in first, went down in second, went way down in third, and then popped up a little bit. But I was expecting, if this was sold to me, the multi-age 21st century learning, that they were just going to fly through the roof. And I really haven't seen that. And then when you got to Hadley, where they didn't sort of have this experiment going on, in 7th, 8th, and 9th grade, those scores actually did go up. But there was really no change. There was no multi-age in 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. Maybe there was more rigor in the teaching. But, again, I don't know how the multi-age is impacting. There's this huge change that we've made. There's no indicator or way of knowing that this really went up. So I'm still, you know, I don't know if there's going to be another parent survey or what's going to happen or if there are plans for the board to change this and go back to, you know, non-fourth and 15th combined. My daughter's in that this year, and I'm definitely not sold on it. I'm not enjoying it. But to the point of, just on another point that Mr. Escalante brought up, my children are Hispanic. And poverty, I think, affects people more than people think. I teach in a high-poverty school district. And I think you talked, Dr. Gordon, quite passionately about teachers and how important they are in a child, in the life of a child. I would also argue that parenting matters quite a bit, too. And that's something I didn't hear mentioned. In my district, I've run into some pretty negligent parents. I don't mean to say all of them are. 100% of my kids are in poverty, or below the students I teach. There's lots of issues that are with that. If you look at a lot of studies, parenting classes for children in poverty, doesn't matter their race, ethnicity, or whatever, help quite a bit. Again, my children adopted from Guatemala. They get all the words in the world from their parents who
you know, both have master's degrees and have a decent command of the English language. Compare them, you know, they culturally they're probably, you know, they're not as Hispanic as a lot of the other students in District 41 just because, you know, they're adopted. But compare them to kids who are in poverty, and there's an absence of words, there's an absence of discussion and talking. And that is like an elephant in the room, because this board has no control over how good or bad a parent is. Okay? And we're all not perfect parents. But I think you would see a bigger pop than through that, through looking at these children who are in poverty, than changing the whole multi-age. I mean, you saw it. 86% of the kids who are of decent income seem to be doing well. I would like to see those stats for years prior. How did those kids who weren't in poverty do before we changed everything around? Were 86% of them meeting or exceeding standards, or were they not? So those are the types of things I'd like to see. Again, I feel like we jumped into this very quickly, and it needs review.
Okay, appreciate that. Just an FYI, we have talked about parenting and, you know, the involvement of parents, and that is important, and I agree. You know, that is something that we've discussed, and we actually have some programs where we try to do some things.
Yeah, the actual program Lincoln is, I mean, that doesn't really involve parenting.
But that's appreciate the comment from your experience, so thank you. Anyone else?
Jeff Cooper. Good evening. First, I'd like to say, Dr. Jordan, I thought it was very interesting presentation you made for words. Even someone who doesn't have kids that have been going through this, be able to sit through those numbers. I got an email today, and the email told me that I knew I wasn't going to be able to make it on time tonight, but it gave me a time frame as to I didn't want to come in the middle of the presentation. So I got here about 8:15. I really wanted to hear the whole discussion on the Senate Bill 16. And what I found was, even though I came 15 minutes before it was estimated that the presentation was going to be done from earlier, that we were already in the middle of talking about it, Senate Bill 16. So I would suggest in the future, I understand we're trying to relegate time frames and stuff in the meetings, but maybe we can get away from being specific like that. I'd have been better off just showing up closer to 8 o'clock, trying to, you know, do the other stuff. Give someone I didn't listen to. I really don't know. That being said, I want to try to understand what happened tonight. So a decision was made tonight to go ahead and get rid of the second public participation.
Correct.
Okay. You guys are making a mistake. What I heard was better communication can be had by cutting back on some communication opportunities. Losing second public participation will take away the ability for feedback from those citizens that are most plugged in, those that have heard the discussions and the votes. Tonight's a great example. I picked up more in the last couple minutes listening to the parents that talked. I just picked up a lot from that. And to cut this off, I think, is really a shame. Would be a mistake if you're going to do this, and it's a bad message to send to the citizens. It says really that we just we want you to fit into what we're doing, and listen to what this hand is saying, even though this hand's taking away something. The town halls are fine, but you are going forward and backward at the same time. Is it really going to do harm to the board to keep the second public participation? In the greater scheme, it's a pittance of time, but the time does have value. One last point, who was in front of the kids, I heard in the discussion, who was in front of the kids on a daily basis is very important. Let's remember this in reference to the growing number of non-illness-related absences, which has already been brought up. It seems to me that kids would do better if they other teacher most or almost all the time. Thank you.
Just a note, because you did come in later, we are going to address the substitute question in our next meeting. We did discuss it, and we felt that we wanted to get some more analysis behind it, so you weren't here, but we will discuss it in the next meeting. Thank you. Anyone else?
Stephanie Clark.
to start with. Wanted to talk about Michelle Gallo talking about special ed. I thought she did a great job. I've met with Michelle already. And I just wanted to mention to the board that, you know, I think she knows she has a lot of work ahead of her the next year. She's going to get her feet wet, figure out what's going on with the district, work with the parents, work with the teachers, and, you know, she might have some new recommendations later, but I think she has a lot to learn and understand before she can really tell anybody any of that. But she's definitely trying to figure all that out. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate that. But one thing I wanted to mention to you, because the board will be impacted, is resources. And I know from the survey that was done in the spring, some of the teacher comments were they feel that resources are limited in the district for reaching some of those kids with IEPs. That's ELL kids, kids that have dyslexia, kids that struggle. They felt there are more kids to be reached if we have better resources. So just putting that bug in your head, that's an issue that might come up. As far as talking, we were talking about the kids at risk, narrowing the achievement gap. I just hope that the board will maybe reevaluate the full-day kindergarten issue, because back in the spring when that was up, I know I talked a lot of times about it, but Team 21, who are the teachers that are teaching our kids, was tasked with figuring out, they were actually examining the time of the day and adding 30 minutes to the school day, and they actually felt that full-day kindergarten would actually be the better solution to narrow the achievement gap to reach those kids, mm-hmm. because they're coming, some of them come into school never having mm-hmm. preschool before, and you have kids that have had preschool for 3 or 4 years. So yeah. I think that is an important issue, and I think we missed the boat a little bit on not talking about that more in the spring before you move forward with facilities, so hopefully we'll reevaluate that. Public participation, I was disappointed. Personally, I have some questions on 21st century initiatives, but I was out of respect for Dr. Gordon. I wanted to wait and have a presentation before I commented. But now I'm going to be forced to comment at the beginning of the meeting before I've actually heard the facts. And I think in time you're going to make public participation longer, time could be wasted. You're going to hear what people have to say, all the questions they have that maybe would have been answered if they had the benefit of hearing what was presented during the meeting. I think you're going to waste time. Or I may, knowing me, I'll just wait and come to the next meeting and tell you that anyway. So you're still probably going to hear it from me. Two questions about that. I'd like to know if all packets will be provided in advance, because there wasn't a packet for 21st century initiatives. And so I couldn't really review it before I commented. And then is the board still going to capture and respond to all questions? Mm-hmm. And you're out of time. The most important thing, please just give me 1 more minute to check that.
Take another.
Okay, sorry, 1 minute and I'll be done, since this is the last one. This is my swan song. The presentation, thanks to Dr. Gordon for that, and I appreciate breaking down the data, but I want to know about the survey and the survey comments on 21st century initiatives. I've made copies for all the board members, so you can read them tonight to help yourself fall asleep. But we spent thousands of dollars on the survey, and the administration maintained that they were an important part of the survey. If you read the comments about the best things in our district, the teachers said that they're one of the best things, that they believe the parents are part of the best things of the district. The parents said time and time again, it was the teachers. And when I read these comments from our most valued commodities in our district, and the educational experts are saying they have concerns about some of the things that we're doing, I can't stand here as a parent and not say something. And I'm not standing here because I'm against 21st century initiatives, but I want to make sure that the board and the school district does what was promised, which is to evaluate changes for fidelity, impact, and satisfaction. I feel like we're just moving on to our next big thing, kind of forgetting about everything else. I lost my train of thought a little bit. But if you, I'd like to know if we're going to do a follow-up survey, because the five essentials survey is required, and it's not really going to evaluate the changes. And if you read some of the quotes from the survey from the teachers, one says, "I don't see significant benefits to multi-age instruction. My range of learners and abilities has widened, not lessened. Writing is especially challenging to teach because there is a very clear difference between fourth and fifth grade writers. The current module was released for fifth graders and is not appropriate for fourth graders." Another teacher says that...
Well, we can...
My time, sorry. But I think it's important to read. I'm just very... Yep. I'm disappointed that there's been no mention of the survey since it was done. It's like, you didn't really like what it said, so we're going to forget about it. I don't know, but I just hope we take what our teachers say seriously and do what was promised. So,
thank you.
May I comment on that? If I can comment, Stephanie.
I have that data with me. I bring it to every single board meeting. I've highlighted it, pulled it out. One of the things that came out in the discussion tonight was our teachers responding to looking at multi-ages second and third and their request to do that second semester in the classroom observation. And that was my comment back, if you remember it, to say we need an update January, February, March. Let's get an update there. April, May, June, let's get another update, and then a decision point. So, in fact, that is reflective of what I was reading in the teacher comments as well. Those comments are absolutely important. We also remember, too, when we talked about this, that's a data point at that point. And so moving forward, a lot of what we're doing in the district, which is the professional development, and also now going to them for their PD to say, what do you want to make sure you better understand how this may help, not help, whatever it is, will inform Dr. Gordon and his cabinet to be able to come to the board. So I appreciate you copying all that. I don't need a set. I have mine.
Okay.
I've highlighted it. I've read through it. It's always with me. And
well, it's a good point about being a data point. That's what I'm saying. I think a follow-up survey does need to be done because you need another data point, anonymous from teachers, to see how things are truly going. I mean, the teachers' concerns, you can say, I'm specifically talking about the teachers, but they have concerns fundamentally with some of the things we're doing and being the best way to reach kids.
So tonight was a preliminary data point, and as we said, we are going to have other conversations around this with other data points. So
it's ongoing. We'll, I just want you to know that it's ongoing.
Trust factors we heard it a year ago. Not taking on you, but six other people.
Yeah, as I said, I thought we didn't necessarily, follow through on that the way I would have liked to. Paul said, give me some time. I need a little time, so we're giving him time. He's starting down that journey, and we will continue to do so. So hopefully you guys will start to see more and more data. So that's what we're looking for, at least. That's what I'm looking for. So. Anybody else?
Thank you for the data. Public participation, I know done issue, but I just have to say my piece. I respect that this is a business meeting and you don't want the public to go on forever. And it's perceived that listening tours and community events are the solution. I personally attended two listening events. At the conclusion of each of those, I was promised follow-up, both individually and as a global group, to the listening tours. I followed up from the one in the spring as to where that was posted, when I would be receiving it, and I never even received a response to that inquiry. So I guess I have very little faith while you're eliminating this as a taxpayer and a parent and a member of the community. I don't feel that that's necessarily, in my personal experience, the best vehicle. Or if it's going to be the vehicle, the results that we receive as participants really needs to change. I also found it interesting, too, that the participation, as Eric stated, has increased over the last couple of years from a public perspective. So it's somewhat interesting to me that obviously there's things going on in the community that are meaningful to all of us. Data, again, to what's already been mentioned a couple times, where's the second and third grade math scores? It was, as a parent, it was told to me that my now third grader in kindergarten was that. It was touted. She will be that full core, common core, start to finish. So I'd be curious to see what that looks like. So I did specialization. Consistency. So Think Tank on March 11th, 2013 promised consistent approach across all elementary schools. That was the basis of what was voted on at that board meeting. While I realize this isn't always possible to have everything match up, I still see that there's a pretty significant degree of inconsistencies from school to school. Communication is one thing. I went last year with 5 communications in total from both of all of my child's teachers. I talked to parents in other grade schools, Lincoln, Frank, or Churchill, and they received weekly communications. I think this year you have 3 teachers at schools that are not specializing. So in Franklin, Forest Glen, Churchill, there's teachers that aren't necessarily specializing, is my understanding. In Franklin, Churchill, Forest Glen, this year there's cases in level 2 where the students stay with each other, they just change teachers, but at Lincoln that may not necessarily be the case. So, you know, we were told over the course of 4 months, this is the answer. Consistency, extra time, wind time. I'd love to know where my child's wind time is. I have heard nothing of wind time since conferences last November when I inquired about it, and they didn't have an answer for me. So I guess just, as a parent, I have concern for not only my child, but all the children in this community. I was born and raised here. We made a conscious decision to come back 12 years ago to raise our children in this community, and I feel like the last couple years that it's not living up to the expectations that I grew up with or the reason that we came back. And I feel like we're taking on a lot, and we're shoving it down our throats without taking some time and just digest and think about it. And what is the impact? These are not mini adults. They're children. What we teach them and the foundation we give them today will impact them in 10 years from now.
Okay. Thank you.
Erin Mayer. I'm also going to comment a little bit about the survey. First, I want to say thank you for the opportunity to be able to speak to you. I've asked this before, and I still remain a little bit unsettled as to what you're doing to measure the social and emotional needs of students after over a year of think tank implementation. Between the multi-agent of the fourth and fifth grade and the teacher specialization of second through fifth grade, I would like to know how you have measured the social and emotional results of this. Some comments that I noticed from the survey completed last year that were alarming to me. Teachers said, I do not feel specialization and multi-age are appropriate in 2-3. I have taught every grade level and feel the social emotional level of both ages are not appropriate for split days and mixed ages. I feel that we are focusing so much on academics and getting kids to high test scores that we are losing sight of the fact that these kids are still 7 and 8 year olds. I have witnessed more tears and breakdowns in level 2 this year than anywhere else. It is a lot to expect of these young children. Another teacher shared, I think socially grouping second and third graders is too much. In August, they are more like first graders than second graders, and they just have nothing in common. Even though they're close in age, they don't have the social skills to figure that out yet. Another comment, I feel there's a big difference between second and third graders developmentally. Finally, a teacher shared, it is difficult to comment on how teachers feel about multi-age, on how students feel about their multi-age experience. We have not asked them these questions directly, and I feel that it would be assuming too much to answer whether or not multi-age has been a positive experience, emotionally and educationally. Students may perform well, yet feel highly uncomfortable. This really shed light on what Dr. Gordon's presentation was tonight as well. You know, the academic portion might be there, but how are we assessing the comfortable, the emotional being met of these students? So I reiterate, how are you measuring how specialization and multi-age are affecting our children socially and emotionally? In addition to the teacher concerns, parents shared many concerns. Some highlights, there are social and emotional risks to multi-aging classrooms. Younger children thrive and are more emotionally secure with same-age peers. The impact of multi-age is detrimental to social and emotional needs of young children. A parent whose child has anxiety, they can't pinpoint where the anxiety stems from, but it's clearly associated with the new method. It's gotten so bad he's now seen a psychologist. Socialization norms are being messed with when integrating ages. My child does not like having two teachers and hauling supplies from one class to another. Kids are young and can't bond with two teachers the way that they can with one. Finally, a parent shared, prior to Forest Glen, my child was in a multi-age setting at school. Bullying increased, self-esteem decreased, and my child's personal needs were met less. Anxiety became high, nightmares and health issues ensued as a result of the stress. So again, I ask what you have done to assess the social and emotional ramifications of multi-age and teacher specialization. Have you brought in child psychologists to assess this? What are you doing in response to the teacher and parent concerns shared in the survey? And I feel that it would be thoughtless and reckless to proceed forward without following up on these survey results, especially the concerns shared by the teachers, who we know are so excellent in this district, who directly experience the social and emotional changes as a result of the implementation of multi-age specialization. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Is that it? Okay, thank you for your comments. I guess we're going to adjourn to closed session. So the board has a need to adjourn to closed session to discuss the appointment, employment, compensation, discipline, performance, or dismissal of specific employees of the district or legal counsel for the district, including hearing testimony and a complaint lodged against an employee or against legal counsel for the district to determine its validity. May I have a motion? May I have a second?
Second.
Roll call.
Mr. Ellis?
Yes.
Mr. Nelson?
Yes.
Mrs. Wilkinson?
Yes.
I'm sorry, Mrs. Wilkinson?
Yes.
Mrs. Galante?
Yes.
Mr. Alger?
Yes.
Mr. Kenwood?
Yes. The board will not be taking any action when it returns to open session. Okay, guys, we're back in open session. We just closed our session. It is currently September 22nd at 10:55 p.m. Back in open session. May I have a motion?
Second.
May I have a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
We're out of closed session. I mean, out of open session. Everyone have a wonderful evening.